This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Future Akins. Future lives here in Lubbock, and the date is Monday, the 12th of January, 2004. I'm in the Special Collections Library interview room here on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Future is at her home here in Lubbock. Future?
Yes.
Can you tell me where you were born and when?
Hampton, Virginia, February 5th, 1950.
And do you have any siblings?
I have one sister, Zandra, and she was born in, where was she born? North Carolina.
Okay, so she's younger than you.
Yeah, yeah, at a base in North Carolina. I can't remember which one.
How do you spell her name?
Z-A-N-D-R-A.
Okay.
And her last name is McClendon.
Okay.
M-C-C-L-E-N-D-O-N.
Okay. And where does she live now?
Austin.
Okay. How long have you been here in Lubbock?
My parents, my dad retired from Michigan, and we moved here in 67.
And did you go to Texas Tech as an undergraduate?
Yes.
And what's your connection to Tech now?
I'm a visiting professor in the School of Art.
Let's talk about your dad. Can you tell me where he was born?
He was born in Hillsboro, Texas. That's in East Texas.
Okay.
He was the youngest of 13.
Of 13 kids?
Of 13 kids.
About when was he born?
I'm trying to remember. I used to know. 1915.
What did his parents do for a living?
His mother had children.
I can see that.
Yeah. His father did a variety of jobs. Mm-hmm. They were usually poor. He was a carpenter during the Depression. Mm-hmm. He and some of my dad's older brothers, my dad never did this, would build houses.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly they were poor. I mean, very dirt poor, like no crayons to go to school with, type poor, and hand-me-downs. None of them. My dad's the only one that even attended college.
What did some of the older brothers end up doing? Did any of them ever enter the military?
Some of their kids did, but not many of them did. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember. My Uncle Wiley, who was my dad's favorite, ended up being like president of Purina or something and was on one of the president's retired councils. He ended up retiring in North Dallas or in the Highland Park of Dallas. He got to be very successful. He was always an outstanding member of that family.
Mm-hmm.
Cullen was an after-dinner speaker sort of for the oil industry around Odessa. Uncle Bill was a sign painter. It's an old dying art.
Right.
In Waco, Texas. I don't remember any of them talking about the service, but my dad was already an uncle by the time he was born,
mm-hmm.
and so a number of his, in essence, nephews were his age.
Right.
And they served. They served together, or they were the ones who served.
You said your dad did go to college.
Yeah, he came. He came to Tech. He first went to Hill Junior College.
Okay.
Then where he played football.
Uh huh.
And then he got a scholarship to Tech. To play at Tech, which is the only way he could go to school. It gave him room and board and food, and then he helped, coach the freshman basketball team and stuff like that. So he played on the 38-39 Cotton Bowl team for Texas Tech.
What position did he play?
Halfback, quarterback.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they played offense, defense. At Tech, in the athletic building, you can see a big picture of that Cotton Bowl team,
uh-huh.
because they were the only team to ever be undefeated and tied.
You're kidding.
My dad's photos in it. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And there's in the Southwest Collection has the video, the early film video, it's now video, of that game. And you see them. My dad played most of it with a concussion. He doesn't remember it.
Is that right?
He didn't remember it, yeah.
Oh, geez.
He scored the only points. They lost. They lost to St. Mary's of Florida, but he, you'll see. And Akins takes the ball down the field. So, he never graduated, though. He was sort of in engineering, but played football, and the war came up, and he joined, and he never graduated.
How is it, do you think, that he ended up going to junior college and then on to a big state school when none of the other kids had done that?
His father hated him, sort of. They didn't get along.
Okay.
He was very close to his mother.
Uh-huh.
And I think my dad just knew he had what he would tell me, he just had to get the hell out of that little hick town.
Okay.
He, even later on when we would have reunions there, he just knew he had to get out. And he was smart. I mean, they would have contests where you'd have to memorize a poem. Mm-hmm. The teacher would write it on the board. And the first one to memorize it would get crayons. So my dad would always be the first one to memorize it.
So that he could get, were the crayons
yeah,
a big,
so he could get, yeah.
Incentive?
I mean, they were poor. I've seen some of the houses. And he just knew that even in the summers when he'd work in the oil field, you know, he said it didn't take long to figure out that working out in the field was dangerous and hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were good with books or could do stuff in the office, it was a better job.
And so he had an incentive to study
yeah.
in that way. Mm-hmm.
And he liked football. He was pretty good at it. He wasn't, he would tell you he wasn't a natural athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other relatives would tell you he was better than he gave himself credit for. But he, it was a way out.
Did he have pretty good relationships with his older brothers and sisters?
I think pretty good because he was the baby.
Uh-huh.
It, you know, it's kind of funny. I always thought of him as straight, you know, straight arrow.
Right.
In the family, he was the wild adventurous one because he joined the military and traveled the world and, you know, he was the baby.
And that was pretty far out for...
Well, my grandfather was a member of the Flatlander Society. He believed the world was flat.
Okay, do you know anything more about that society?
Only that my grandfather, in terms of, he was from Hillsboro, Texas, Church of Christ.
Uh-huh.
The Bible said the four corners of the earth. So when my parents were getting ready to go to Thailand, they gave him a globe so he could track our travels.
Right.
He smashed it with a cane because it was
kidding.
Blasphemy. No. It was my grandfather, Uncle Bill. I mean, he was called Uncle Bill by everybody, but he was my grandfather.
Uh-huh.
Because it was blasphemy. And so he hated football, hated that my dad played football. When my dad was in the Cotton Bowl, he wouldn't even go see him.
Really?
It was just in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
He stayed in the motel room that my dad got for him and listened to it on the radio, but never acknowledged that Dad did well during that.
How did your grandmother cope with all of that? Was she of the same mind?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. She and my dad were extremely close, but my grandfather was like 6'4", and my grandmother was like 5', and she had 13 kids. I mean, when I asked my aunts how'd she die,
mm-hmm.
they said woman problems. I said, well, what?
Right.
You know, what does that mean? Is that going to help my doctor?
Right.
And they said, 13 kids. I said, that's still not helping my doctor. You
know? How long did she live? To what age?
I'm not sure, because she died before I was born.
Okay.
I know she died in my dad's arms, that he came home on leave sometime and she died.
Okay.
My grandfather died sometime after we were in Thailand. But these are all stories passed down.
Sure, sure.
I don't remember globes being smashed or anything.
Your grandfather sounds like a real pistol.
Yeah, he dominated the family. We always used to have family reunions on Father's Day in his honor, and my dad would just get livid because he was like, it's my mother who did all the work. This man was mean, cantankerous, and poor most of his time. You know? But, you know, it was just East Texas patriarchal bullshit.
Was your grandfather born in Texas?
No, he's actually from Grace, Alabama.
Okay.
They came. We tracked back the family enough. He had traveled to East Texas from Grace, Alabama,
uh-huh.
and so had my grandmother.
And so they had been married in Alabama?
I guess so. You know, that part of it I can't really remember.
Uh-huh.
I'd have to look it up. I know that you know, before that it was probably through Appalachia and Scotland. You know, Scott.
Okay.
So
Scott's
but,
Irish background.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Akins is of that.
And they had always spelled it the same way that you do?
We're not sure. We sort of accept anything A-K-I-N-S, A-T-K-I-N-S, A-D,
okay.
It's close.
Okay.
I mean, it's all very, very close.
Okay. Did your dad maintain an interest in sports after he left Texas?
Oh, hell yeah. We went to every football game Tech ever had.
Is that right?
Even after his stroke, yes.
Now you're talking about the let's see, late 1960s.
We moved here in 1967
uh-huh.
because he had been a letterman, triple
right.
letterman or whatever. He got, oh, What did he get? He got one free ticket, and then he got two tickets for the price of one because he went on to be director of financial aid at Tech.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He, you know, there's not much use for retired lieutenant colonels.
Right.
So he found a niche, and he loved helping kids go to school because it was so hard for him to go to school. So he was great at it. I mean, he was a wonderful. I mean, I have letters when he died that mm-hmm. talked about how good he was. And so we went to every game.
And
every game. And we got there an hour early.
Uh-huh. And he took you along. Did he take your sister as well?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. There was no choice. My mom, my sister, and I. And then later on, he bought tickets for boyfriends that would be involved,
uh-huh.
our husbands. We had to get there an hour early because he wanted to see the teams work out because he could tell a lot about how they were by that.
Mm-hmm.
He sat with some other old cronies kind of in the same general area that felt no restrictions when it came to yelling at coaches or refs. They weren't obnoxious, drunk fans.
Mm-hmm.
They just really knew football.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew when people weren't playing good football. Oh, no.
How did you dress for going to a football game in the late 60s? And
you wore dresses.
Is that right?
You wore outfits. It was a fancy thing. In fact, Mom would go and just watch how people dress. Often the women kind of had sort of winter hats on and gloves and hose.
So it was a big old deal.
It was a big old deal. It didn't work real well for me, but it was a big old deal.
Now, do you say that because you're not a dyed-in-the-wool football fan, or?
I think because when I was at Tech and in graduate school, Saturdays were the days that we went hunting for sheet metal and old metal to use in our artwork.
Okay.
And so I would do that till the very last minute before the game, and then I would go in and I'd just have on my jeans and sweatshirt. And you know what? The game was the same. No one cared. And after my dad had a stroke, he just went in his jumpsuit because that's all he wore.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I think over time you just go, you know, if I'm really here to see the game, it doesn't matter if I have on pantyhose or not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What jobs, you mentioned that your dad had, did he actually work in the oil fields when he was younger?
Yeah, just between summer, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff did he do, do you know?
Well, I know that he did books for him sometimes.
Cause okay.
He said, you know, you'd be in a bar in Odessa or Kermit or somewhere in the oil fields, and, you know, a guy would come in swinging a chain. And he just didn't want to be there. He just thought it was horrible work. I mean, he'd grown up his whole life around poverty and the meanness
mm-hmm.
from poverty.
Right.
He worked one summer pulling rickshaws at the state fair.
You're kidding.
No, he and my cousins, I guess they are,
uh-huh.
his nephews, pulled rickshaws.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it was just, you know, you just did what young men could do.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
How did he make the football team at Hill Community?
He'd been really good at the high school, at
okay.
Hillsborough High School.
Hillsborough High School.
Yeah, he was really good.
And was he playing both offense and defense?
Yeah,
back then too?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And did he get a scholarship to go to the community college?
He must have, because there's no other way he would have gone. Because I know he never really, he would tell stories about being at Tech, and he wouldn't have money for one class or something, and he'd sit outside the door.
Okay.
And a teacher would, like, say, you're not registered. He says, I don't care if I'm registered. I'm going to learn. And he could never buy his books. He'd have to check him out of the library.
Wow.
Yeah. So when he ended up being, you know, working for financial aid,
mm-hmm.
he was great.
He was very empathetic.
Oh, well, what he said is he didn't pay for fraternities or new cars. And this is the funny part, he refused to handle any scholarships for athletes.
Really? How come?
He knew they were corrupt.
You mean by that?
He knew, I mean, that the whole football, that how football had grown
mm-hmm.
from his day had become corrupt with alumni and liars and just, and that the kids they were bringing up, they weren't getting degrees, they weren't getting educated.
Okay.
And he saw how they misused the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want any part of it. He thought it was, A, illegal and, two, immoral.
And so did he kind of refuse to handle that paperwork
yeah,
and someone
yeah.
else did it?
No. It was handled by the athletic
okay.
department. He just thought it was illegal. He knew that they'd get busted for it.
Do you think that's the time when athletic scholarships sort of began to come under the athletic department as opposed to scholarships?
Yeah, because it's always sneaky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want any part of it. My dad was an extremely ethical, moral person. And one of the things that he talked about, which he was never proud of, was that when he pulled rickshaws, he did it with two nephews. One, Billy Tom Akins,
uh-huh.
who went on to be a pilot with my dad, and he was taken on Corregidor,
mm-hmm.
prisoner of war for 52 months, came back, flew with my dad again, took up a plane that blew up. He was a test pilot, blew up. Anyway, Billy Tom was a great pilot, but he's also good looking, and then my cousin Larry. Larry would start fights, and they would roll gay guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because both Billy Tom and Larry were extremely good looking. And my dad talked about how they did it once, and although he took part in it, it always shamed him.
Really?
Yeah.
Did he talk to you about that at
some
point?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, mm-hmm. He did. And there were real life lessons where he knew he had made the wrong decision. And he just, as he grew older, he wasn't going to be a part of it. When he knew it was wrong, he stood up and said, "That's wrong."
Did he give you any details that you recall about those incidents? Was that attacking or hurting gay men? Did that happen particularly at the fair?
Yeah, it happened at the fair. Mm-hmm. And Billy Tom, Billy Tom and Larry, because Billy Tom died young, but Larry's only died a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Really good-looking, handsome Clark. Billy Tom looked like Clark Gable.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Larry looked like Jimmy Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Good-looking men, well-built, broad-shouldered. They would go in a bar, and in those days, there were gay bars, but they would just go in a mixed bar.
Uh-huh.
And, they would start, some guy would hit on them. And they would say, "Well, yeah, come on, meet me in the back alley."
Yeah.
And then, and the thing was that my dad said, he said, half the time, Larry just wanted to fight. Hell, he just wanted to get in a fight. And mm-hmm. so they'd pick on some straight guy, because he just wanted to get in a fight. But they would sometimes intentionally pick on a gay guy to either, not so much take his money, but to beat him up. And he was like, he was always ashamed that he took part in any of it, in the whole notion that you needed to be in a fight, or that you needed to take to a trap something like that. He was never proud of it. It just, he told it in a way to try to let us understand that some of the best people can get you in really bad situations.
But you sense from him some pain and remorse around that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just, he knew it was wrong. He just knew it was wrong, and it was what everyone did.
Right, and it's interesting that he would tell you about it.
Yeah, well, I think it helped that I was the artist. Although my sister was really wild, I was the artist. And when we were stationed in Arkansas, his number one assistant, Lieutenant Palmer,
mm-hmm.
was gay. Although, no one ever openly mentioned it, but he collected antiques and lived with his mother and raised Weimaraners.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad could not have done the job he did without that man. So, and on top of that, when my dad had open-heart surgery, he mm-hmm. had an out-of-body experience and says he talked to God, and God just told him it wasn't his job to judge.
Really?
Yeah, really. And dad had had some strange experiences in the wars, and so. And he came back, and one of my women friends was getting married to her partner,
uh-huh.
and, of course, she'd been disowned by her family, and my dad just said, "Well, hell, I'll stand up for you."
Really?
Yeah. And so as he aged, he was less afraid, although he was known in the service as someone who spoke his mind,
mm-hmm.
he was less afraid to speak it on all issues.
Wow.
Yeah. And he just knew it was wrong.
Future, let's talk about him,
okay.
him being at Tech.
Okay.
He played on the football team. What did he study?
Engineering, chemical, I think. Yeah, chemical engineering. And
okay.
then he would have to do these big blueprints. I mean, he was petroleum engineering in those days.
Okay.
To, you know, it's the oil field, and that's what Tech was known for. He would have to, like, pull up his grades because he'd always mess up on a blueprint or something. And he'd take a drama course or an English course and pull it up. So he has, like, 200-something hours at Tech. It's no degree.
How did it happen that he did not graduate?
Because there weren't any counselors in those days
okay.
telling you what to take.
Okay.
And he just, you know, he transferred courses from Hill College, and there was nobody in the state legislature saying, you have to leave now. You know, he just, he played football and coached basketball.
And coached basketball.
Well, he played basketball, but he also coached freshman basketball.
Uh-huh. So he did play on the Tech basketball team as well?
Yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh.
I know more about football.
Okay.
You know,
because you
I,
had to go to football games.
Yeah, and because I, oh, you know, and just because football was his love. I mean, he, it's sort of what he knew, and I know that my Uncle Pat, my mom's youngest brother, my dad would let, he'd leave one door open to the Tech gym so that Uncle Pat and his buds could sneak in at night and play basketball. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Did he tell you other stories about, like, for example, where he lived or people that he knew while he was on campus as a student?
He lived in a place called La Fonda, which
okay.
was the dorm mm-hmm. for the athletes.
Mm-hmm.
He was coached under Pete Cothran.
How do you spell that last name? Do you know?
No, but Tech would know. It's a legendary coach of Tech.
Okay.
There were people like Elmer Tarbox, who developed the Tarbox weights
mm-hmm.
that people use now on his team. He talked a lot about how Pete Cothran would teach the boys how to eat, because they were all a bunch of hicks.
Right.
And how to act in public.
Really? I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He never got along with Coach Cothran very well, because my dad would sometimes work summers with one of my uncles selling clothes, and so my dad was always a dude.
Okay.
Once
you mean with
money,
regard to his dress?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And Coach Cothran just thought that he was a dude, you know, and just dismissed him.
Okay.
It's just that he was such a fast runner and had such quick hands that he
yeah.
couldn't. I mean, he was on his starting team. I was trying to think, mainly that, you know.
Did he ever talk about traveling with the team?
Well, on the train, and the coach would talk to him about, how do you act? He said, boys, I don't mean to offend you, but you're a bunch of hicks. This is how you eat. These are the utensils you use. You don't slurp your soup. You don't
wow.
chug your milk. You know, you wear your tie
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. Yeah.
Did the guys kind of fall in with that, do you know, or did they?
Oh, yeah, if they didn't, they got kicked off the team.
Really?
Oh, he was a taskmaster. I mean,
okay.
there are books written about Pete Cothran.
Okay.
It was like he believed two things. Either you needed to be Native American or go to Notre Dame to be a great football player. Because both of them had God on their side.
Right.
You know,
uh-huh.
and so it was a racist, you know, bigoted thing. Didn't want to have girls around. Knew everybody did, but he didn't want to have girls around.
Uh-huh.
You know. Old-fashioned, think Newt Rockne football. I mean, they wore leather helmets.
Yes, that's right.
It's hilarious. Oh, and he redesigned their football outfits, because I guess Notre Dame had to make them a lot of different, you know, really bright colors, a lot of stripes,
uh-huh.
to distract people when you were running.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Did your dad keep any of those uniforms? Or?
He did, but one of my aunts-in-laws, when uh-huh. my dad was overseas in the war,
uh-huh.
gave them to all her brothers, and my dad never got them back.
Oh, ouch.
So all his Letterman sweaters and blankets, and yeah, they were all given away to her brothers.
Did he affiliate in some way with the ROTC or find out about the military when he was at Tech?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Not that I know of. I think he was either going to be, what was he going to be? Submarines, parachutes, or jet pilots? Or pilot.
These were the things he was interested in?
Yeah, he wanted the ones that were out there.
Now, when did he actually, when did he leave Tech? Do you know? Roughly?
I think it must have been about 39, 40.
Okay.
Around 40. I mean, actually, it could be looked up in the Tech records. But
sure.
He joined the Army Air Corps and learned to be a pilot.
Now, he enlisted.
Yes.
Right? And it was before, it was substantially before Pearl Harbor.
I would think so, because my mother was already in California in Pearl Harbor.
She
was on the switchboard when it hit.
Oh, okay. But they did not know each other yet.
Yes.
Oh, they did.
They met in Lubbock.
She
was sitting in a drugstore, an old drugstore in Lubbock called Broadway Drug, which is now, I don't know what it is now, it's something else now.
Where is that building?
It used to be on the corner of Broadway and University.
Okay.
On the north corner of Broadway and University. It's a place called Broadway Drug.
Mm-hmm.
Old-time drugstore where you get sodas. Mm-hmm. And my dad walked in with some football players and said, oh, my God, I'm going to date that woman. And they said, no, you're not. She dates the high school football star. A guy named, I can't remember what his name was, but anyway. And Dad said, not only I'm going to date her, but I'm going to marry her. I mean, this is the story they tell.
Right.
And he finally asked her out, and she said, okay, meet me at midnight in front of the phone company. Well, Dad goes, yeah, right. Well, Mom worked nights at the phone company.
Oh.
So he stood her up for the first date.
Whoops.
Uh-huh. And they started dating, and they dated for 10 years. It took them 10 years to get married.
10 years.
Well, as Dad said, the war came. Mom moved to California to help with a dying brother. Dad was a pilot, you know.
Uh-huh.
Mom married somebody else for 6 months. Yeah.
Now, was she born in Lubbock, or where was she from?
Technically, she was born in Oklahoma, but moved here at 3 months.
What was her name?
Geraldine Virginia Fulton.
Okay. And the Fultons came to Texas when she was a baby?
Yeah. From Oklahoma. They settled in Lubbock because the radiator of my grandfather's car went out. And he thought, if my radiator goes out here, somebody else's will too. And so he owned a radiator shop in downtown Lubbock. I know. And they had a home on 10th Street,
that's
now, of course, destroyed, where they rented out the back house to a young musician named Leonard Sly, who would go on to become Roy Rogers.
Roy Rogers lived in their rental unit?
Uh-huh, in the Sons of the Pioneers, yes. It's when Tim Spencer married Velma, who's a Lubbock girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. My mom had a date with Roy Rogers.
Did she ever tell you about it?
Yes.
What happened?
He kissed her and he had liver lips. It was so disheartening to know that my mother had dated the person I had a crush on.
Oh, did you? You had a crush on him as well?
Yeah, because he was on TV.
And did you, when he was on TV, did you know that he had lived in your grandparents' place? Did you know he was in Lubbock?
Well, I kind of did.
I
kind of did because he always sent every album they made, he sent a copy of it to my grandparents.
No kidding.
Yeah, and when Tim Spencer, whenever he came to town, he stopped by to see my parents, and I found a picture of my parents with him when they went. And either he was here or they were there in California. No, my grandmother fed him for a couple summers. I mean, yeah. They wrote. I mean, he always. So they had every Sons of the Pioneers album. And
that's amazing.
I know.
Now, the move to Lubbock from Oklahoma, when did that happen? Was that part of the Depression move?
I'm not sure. My grandfather never talked about it. The story was he had run away with my grandmother when she was 14.
Okay.
Her brothers came and got her back, and so he had to wait till she was 16 to come and get her again.
Okay.
And then they just moved to. But by the time they would have moved here, my mom was the second born, the third born.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have already had two kids.
And she was born when?
I see. If my dad was in 15, my mom would have been in 20. No. Yeah, 20.
Oh, okay. So it's well before the Depression that she was born.
Trying to get that right. See, I think my dad, 915. Yeah, dad was born in 15, so mom would have been born in 20. Yeah, but she lived through the Depression in Lubbock. Yeah, it was tough. That's why they rented out their back house for Roy Rogers.
Did she tell you much about, or did you ever learn much about what the Depression was actually like in Lubbock? Did you hear stories?
Yeah, it was horrid. It was. My grandfather had the main stories they told was there were two radiator shops in town, and my dad saw a lot of, my granddad saw a lot of his most loyal customers going to the other radiator shop.
Uh-huh.
And he figured out, he had never made it past the third grade. I mean, he had just been a working cowboy, and he, you know, was going to the third grade when he was about 15.
Uh-huh.
You know, because you go for a day or two and then not go.
Sure.
And he got a crush on the teacher, and the teacher kind of had a crush on him, and he decided see, I come from this really strange moral family, that it wasn't right for him to be spooning after the teacher, so he quit. So he could barely read and write. I mean, he could just, but he could sort of cipher stuff, is what he'd say. He could cipher it. And so he went up to his loyal customers, and he took all their IOUs and tore them up. He said, I need a little bit of business, but if you're going to avoid me because of what you owe, I'm going to tear it up.
Did it work?
Yeah. Of course it worked.
And people came back.
Yeah, people came back, and they survived. I mean, it was poor. It wasn't poor like my dad's was poor. My dad was dirt poor. If you don't catch the fish tonight, we're not eating. My grandfather and my grandmother, they always had something, but it was mainly that my grandmother was much too young to have kids, mean, or to be married and all that. It was a bitter, mean woman, and my grandfather worked a lot.
So your grandmother was mean?
Yeah.
Do you remember her?
Oh, yeah, sure. She was mean.
Was she? This isn't just a story. This is real.
She was mean, and she was, you know, she was Baptist, and she taught Revelations, and she not only was mean, but she had God on her side to be mean.
Now, when you say she taught Revelation, what do you mean by
in
that?
In Sunday school class. She taught the book of Revelations, which is the one about hell, fire, damnation, and you're going, you know. And so she needed, as she got older, she had a series of heart attacks. So I remember as a round little thing with gray hair and lots of jewelry on. She always said, this is so weird, French provincial furniture in this little ranch house. So she wanted really fine things that we had to polish every Saturday when we'd come to visit. I have fond memories of polishing everything in life.
Sounds like it.
Oh, yeah. And she just was, she just sort of played favorites, and she was kind of a righteous, mean-spirited person, you know? I mean, she cooked all day long and made jams and jellies. I mean, she took a good house, but she would do things I heard, and I heard this to other relatives of my dad. My mother would have, like, made cheerleader at high school, but she wouldn't let my mom be cheerleader because she said it would cost too much money, and then she'd go out and buy a new coat for herself. I mean, just, she was very jealous. She was too young to have kids. My mom was a natural beauty, and she was just really jealous of my mom, and she would rent out rooms in the house when as the kids moved off and let them wear my mom's clothing.
Yikes.
And the mom was expected to iron for them and stuff. Throwing oatmeal, her favorite thing was to throw things, you know. They built a separate bathroom onto the house because she didn't want my grandfather coming into the house from working, you know. And he just, like, converted a garage into a den because he called it the dog house because he could stay out there and never have to see her.
Wow.
You know, I mean, they were just, and we just thought it was normal because we only saw him till we moved here. We moved here to take care of him.
In the late 60s.
Yeah, in 67. We moved here so we could take care of him. When I was married in 72, I lived in the little rent house behind my grandparents so I could watch him.
And how long did they live on?
I was widowed in December of 73, and my grandmother died in January of 74.
Wow, that's hard.
Yeah, yeah, to the day, yeah. And so, you know.
You mentioned your mom going to high school, and she could have potentially have been a cheerleader. Was that Lubbock High then?
Yeah, she went to Lubbock High.
And what year did she graduate?
She would have graduated in 38, but she had an appendicitis attack and had to graduate in the summertime.
And where did she get treated for that?
I'm not sure, but it was probably the old St. Mary's, which is now Cafe J's.
Okay.
Yeah.
There on 19th Street.
Yeah, that's the old St. Mary's Hospital.
And St. Mary's has subsequently become
Covenant
Hospital. Okay.
Yeah, run by Catholic nuns.
Okay. Your mom, was she a good student?
I think she was an okay student. I think my mom was pretty.
She was pretty.
My mom was gorgeous.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, in a very beautiful, natural way. Very big busted, very thin, brown hair, big brown eyes. Just pretty. She's just a pretty, pretty woman. She was kind of a dingbat. I think she was bipolar. Went on to become a raging alcoholic. I don't think she was a good student. I think she was probably a studious student, and I think she was... You know, please, I don't think she would have ever caused waves. She dated just remembered it. The guy she made was Jumbo Webster. He was a big football hero. So I think that's what she did.
Do you think she sort of felt that she needed to get by on her looks kind of thing? Or
I don't know. I don't know if I think it was tough for women to think any other way.
True.
I mean, she went on during the war to work two jobs.
Uh-huh.
One as a switchboard operator and one, I don't know what other one she worked, but there were two of them. And so women learned to be independent. I think that she was caught in the transition of what is it I'm told I have to be,
mm-hmm.
and what is it that I really long to be. And I don't know if she ever thought about what she wanted to be. I think it was an empty void in her that she could never, you know.
Yes.
The women's movement used to call it, what is it, the pain with no name.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was just a prime example of that.
Now, she graduated from Lubbock High,
yeah.
and then did she get a job here in town with us?
Yeah, with a phone company, uh-huh. and then she transferred with a phone company when one of her older brothers, her favorite brother, was out in California, diagnosed with rheumatic fever, couldn't really take care of his family anymore. She went out there to help care for his family, his wife, and two girls, and she just wanted to get the hell out of Dodge, and then
uh-huh.
she went there and worked as a switchboard operator and then worked for a airplane company. She wasn't a welder, but she was like in the office type thing.
Okay, now where in California did she go?
Huntington Beach.
Okay. And she worked for the phone company for a while. You said she was on the switchboard at the time of
yeah.
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, she was she said she was there and instantly the entire board lit up.
Really?
Yeah, she said it was terrifying, scary, and you couldn't do that many at a time.
Did she know what had happened?
She did. Within moments.
Okay. And do you remember her telling you anything more about that time?
Just that.
Mm-hmm.
That she was terrified of the Japanese invading California.
Mm-hmm.
She, when we would get in arguments about the internment of Japanese Americans,
yes.
she was just livid that they were spies and out to get you.
Now, this is many years later after the war.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But she'd never, you know, she would say, I'm liberal. I'd go, but Mom. And she just talked about, you know, rationing stuff and working two jobs, and she had four different boyfriends, including my dad,
uh-huh.
you know. I mean, it, for her, it was kind of like hard times, good parties.
Did she stay in touch then with your dad?
Oh, absolutely. He used to fly out to see her, and they wrote to each other. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And her working in the airplane company front office. Do you remember what company that was?
I'll think of it.
Okay.
It'll come to me. It's been bought up by someone a couple of times since then. But I'll think of it. Okay.
What was she doing there?
You know, I have no clue. My aunt's future went out there to be with her, and she worked the assembly line, but Mom was in the office somehow. I'm sure she was either maybe switchboard again.
Now, your aunt's name was Future as well?
Her real name was Wanda Mae Fulton.
Okay.
And at 17 and a half, she was 6 feet tall and a redhead. And and she said, I'm getting the hell out of Dodge. She never even graduated from high school. And she went out to live with my mother in California and
uh-huh.
changed her name to Future Fulton because she wanted to be an actress or showgirl.
Are you serious?
I'm very serious.
That's great. Did she ever get a break or anything like
that?
Well,
she didn't get huge breaks, but she did. You know, she did go on to do USO shows and be in something in Miami in one of those swimming aqua things
uh-huh.
where you're a synchronized swimmer
right.
and a diver.
Right.
And then she studied on Broadway with Strasberg and then, you know, and modeled some and then married a millionaire and then divorced him and then married a playboy and divorced him and then married an actor and then died of breast cancer, you know. And so she didn't get the break that she wanted, but she got the life she wanted.
She sounds great.
She was wild.
Now, that's your mom's younger sister.
Oh, yeah.
How many? Did she have a yet younger sister? Or
no, it was my aunt. Future was 5 years younger than my mother, and then my Uncle Pat's 5 years younger than Aunt Future.
Okay.
And so, and Pat, by the time he ran away from home, he joined the, Corps of Engineers type people.
So he was in the Army?
You know, it's not even, it's somebody who goes, I mean, he was in Brazil
okay.
building bridges and doing engineering.
So some kind of civilian organization
yeah.
of the government?
Yeah.
But, mm-hmm.
He does work for the government. I mean, they do work for the government, but they're not government.
I see. Yeah. Uh-huh. Like a contractor or something.
Yeah, yeah. And he spent a lot of time in South, I mean, all over the world. He spent all over the world because everybody wanted to get the hell away from Lubbock. and my grandparent, my grandmother.
Right. And did he go to Lubbock High as well?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, Pat Fulton.
And they stayed in that same house then on 10th Street.
They did until, I guess, Uncle Pat left, and then they moved out on 82nd Street.
Oh, that's a long way out.
Yeah. My grandfather wanted to live in the country, and he owned about a block of property, and he just sort of farmed cotton. He wasn't a great farmer or anything. He
uh-huh.
They just made ends meet. I'm not quite sure how.
Had he sold the shop?
Yes, he had.
Uh-huh. And where was that shop located?
It's now where the parking lot of the, I guess it's Lubbock National Bank. It's a drive-in parking lot across from the courthouse.
Okay. And you mentioned that the house on 10th Street had been destroyed.
Yeah, by McDougal.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
No, I just don't know. I mean, it had, the house they had lived in probably 20 years ago had been torn down to build an apartment before McDougal. Now it's in that area that McDougal is like this, you know, building that whole new, it's called North Overton, and mm-hmm. it's just all been bulldozed.
And that would be Mayor McDougal?
No, it's his brother.
His brother, okay. Your dad left Texas Tech.
Mm-hmm. To go to join the Air Force.
Okay. And where did he enlist? Do you know whether it was here or was it?
I just can't imagine it. I had to have been here. I mean, he did, he was in the first jet flying school, and he became a pilot. I mean, I know he was in Arizona. But he was mainly stationed in Virginia.
Did you ever hear how he came to become a pilot?
More money.
Is that what he was interested in?
Well, he was interested in fighting for America.
Okay.
But it seemed cool that you got to fly and you get more money for doing it.
Okay. And that had been one of the things that he was kind of interested in.
I think he was interested in anything that took him away from Texas.
Okay, wow.
You know, I just think he was a young man who wanted to see more. I mean, he told my mom, you know, if you hitch your star to my wagon, I'll take you anywhere. I mean, I just think he was an adventurous young man who, you know, they didn't get married till after the war because my dad didn't think he was going to come back. He thought he was going to die.
He joined the Army Air Corps.
Correct.
Did he ever consider, do you know, the Navy or another branch of service?
Only if he hadn't have gotten in.
Okay.
He knew he was going to get in one of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And his initial training, can you tell me what you know about where he did basic?
I think it was mainly in Virginia, because that's where all the stories of him flying to see my mom and my mom coming out to see him were based around Virginia and Newport News and where I was born.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Dad never talked much about himself. He would tell you everything about the courage of others. It wasn't until he died and we were putting on his uniform that I realized he had medal type, good medals.
Really?
Yeah. It was one of my like third or fourth cousins who'd gotten a Navy Star.
Mm-hmm.
Who came up to me and had it on at the funeral, and he said, do you know that your dad's like my hero? And I went, no. And he said, I wore my Navy Star for your dad, because your dad has this medal. And I said, and? He said, you have no clue, do you? And I said, right. Because Dad didn't ever talk about it.
Right.
It was what you did.
Where do you think he got that sense of duty and the, as the youngest, he probably at least had some incentive to kind of, you know, get attention. And I wonder how that fits. Do you have any ideas?
I think that I have some really had some, most of them are dead now, but one of them aunts
uh-huh.
who really loved him.
Uh-huh.
And I think his mother really loved him because he was the last.
Right.
I think that he had some teachers along the way. He had his older brother Wiley. really took him under his wing.
Uh-huh.
And I just think Dad put it all together in a way that it came out to be, he wasn't impressed with braggarts at all.
Right.
Because I think he'd seen too many of them within his own family. I mean, we used to have family reunions, so there'd be 160 of us together, you know. Talk about bullshit. And he knew that sometimes, I mean, he knew his mother was a very quiet little woman,
mm-hmm.
how much work she did.
Yeah.
And I think he was always fascinated with learning. I mean, he loved to read. I used to do his charts for him when he didn't have to give a presentation in the military, because
mm-hmm.
I have good handwriting and can do calligraphy.
Mm-hmm.
And he just understood charts. I mean, he had the knack for seeing the overall picture. I think from early on, he knew he didn't want to be a carpenter. I mean, he didn't want to be poor. He didn't desire to be super wealthy. His idea of wealth was you pay cash for a car and you have ice cream every night.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't about a lot. It was about enough. He just didn't want to ever not have enough.
And his career in the military sort of parallels that in that he
yes.
didn't necessarily want to stay in the very showy and
right.
very well-rewarded fighter pilot category
yeah.
if that meant he couldn't.
Yeah, well, one, his eyes got bad, but two,
uh-huh.
he loved SAC because it was, in a sense, it was the behind-the-scenes work that SAC did. It was the coordination between ground and air.
Mm-hmm.
It was, let's make it the best it can ever be. You know, let's be the premier of it all, and let's do it as a team. And I think he learned team ethics from sport. I mean, I think he,
mm-hmm.
I think because he was so involved and had coached a little bit too, he knew one great player can't make a team.
Right.
And he really, I mean, when he taught Sunday school, he used a lot of parallels with team sports and the idea that one person can't do it. You have to do it together, and it's not about you getting all the headlines.
Did he have particular friends that he made while he was over in Europe that you know about, people that he kept up with?
Not. I know that, yeah, there were some men that he served with
mm-hmm.
that he kept up with until my mom got so bad drinking and then Dad just stopped socializing. Because I had to write them and let them know he had died.
Okay. Do you know what unit he was assigned to?
No, but I could look it up.
Okay.
I just don't know.
That's okay. Do you remember him telling anything about the end of the war and where he might have been?
No, isn't that funny? I don't.
Okay. Did he stay in Europe for any length of time, or was he...
No,
he came back to the
States. He came back to the States.
And he had decided that he wanted to stay in the military?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know when that kind of decision...
When the war was over with, because you had a chance to stay or to go.
Yes.
And he saw a couple of things that, you know, when they came back stateside after the end of the war, when
mm-hmm.
the war was winding down, you became a test pilot.
Now,
I mean, you were still a pilot, but there were so many planes being
yes.
developed that one of the things you did was you took them up and tested them.
Yes.
And that's when his nephew, Billy Tom, was killed because a plane blew up on him.
Can we talk about Billy Tom for a second?
Sure.
He was in the Army Air Corps as well.
Yes.
And at
Corregidor.
Pearl Harbor, was he in...
No. He would have been stateside and went to Corregidor.
Okay. And he was captured.
Yes.
Do you know the circumstances of his capture?
Only that if he had ever run into MacArthur, he would have killed him.
Was he downed from the air, or was
no,
he in a...
Okay. Well, he must have been because he was a pilot. He must have been. You know, I don't know how he got there, but he was stuck there, and MacArthur, he would have killed MacArthur.
He hated MacArthur.
Hated.
And the reason for that is?
He deserted them, and he took furniture and personal items instead of men.
Okay. And that, did that hatred help him survive, do you think?
Well, Billy Tom, the stories I've heard about Billy Tom mm-hmm. is he said that there are three people who won't survive. The first that won't survive are the ones who think that they're smart.
Okay.
Because they think they can figure a way down it, and there's not.
Okay.
The second ones were the religious ones because they pray and think that God's going to save them, and that's not going to happen. And then the third ones were, I can't remember what the third ones were, but he had this rule. he knew he was none of the three anyway. So how he survived, one is he quickly figured out that they got the same food that their captors had.
Is that right?
That there just wasn't much food.
Okay.
That there was no telling how long it was going to be, and they were just going to have to do it. Where they ended up was a place that processed, I guess, rice, but the machinery wasn't working. So he convinced them he knew how to fix the machinery, which he didn't know jack shit about.
Mm-hmm.
But he had met a man who was a machinist, but was blind.
Now, was that someone else who was in the camp?
Yes, someone else in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, this guy's my partner, we have to do it together. And so he would explain things, and then they would fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And he could take a few little handfuls of rice back. Not handfuls, you know. And that's how he got through.
From what was processed in the machine once it was working?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's how he got through. You know, 52 months.
52 months.
Mm-hmm.
Was he in, do you know, future, if you don't know, it's fine. Was he in the same camp the whole time? Was he moved?
I don't know, but I actually, if you're interested, my aunt Betty, who would have been his sister-in-law,
uh-huh.
wrote him, this is the type of women I come from, every week. He
really?
Was captured, yes.
And did he receive those letters?
A couple, not all, but a couple.
Uh-huh.
More importantly, the woman he had been engaged to went on to marry someone else, and when he was released,
mm-hmm.
she divorced the other guy and immediately married him.
No kidding.
Yeah, Betty counts.
And where did she live?
Hillsboro, Texas.
Okay.
They're all from around Hillsboro and Fort Worth and all that, but
uh-huh.
Betty lives in Odessa. So.
And is Aunt Betty still around?
Yep.
Okay.
Aunt Betty's still around.
Uh-huh.
So I'll
that would be fascinating to talk with her.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's just the type of woman she was.
And he did get a couple of letters.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know any stories about his liberation or how he was freed?
No, but Betty would. I mean,
okay.
I just know that, you know, Dad said you talked to him about it, and he'd act like he had just gone to the supermarket.
Really?
Yeah, and so he showed up at my dad's place, and, you know, the same unit with my dad, asked to be with my dad, and said, let's fly.
And now this was when they were testing. Pilot,
yeah.
The test pilot period.
Yeah.
And he was, he came back into or stayed in the Army Air Corps, then becoming the Air Force.
Yes.
And he wanted to fly.
Yeah.
And he did fly.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, about his apparently all too brief career as a test pilot?
He was great. He was a wonderful, brilliant pilot. The family myth, which I really, my sister thinks she can confirm, but I haven't been able to. Is that my, you know, that they'd gone out drinking the night before. My dad had a hangover, and Billy Tom said, I'll take up the next flight. They said, oh, I'm scheduled to. And he said, no, let me. And he took it up, and he mentioned seeing a bright light, I mean, over the, you know, when they're talking about
yes.
how the plane's working.
Yes.
And then it blew. And so Dad thinks, Dad always told my sister he thought it was some UFO thing, but all he knew is that he had to take back an empty coffin to his wife in Hillsboro.
Uh-huh.
And just that I mean, Dad said, he didn't talk about it. You would have thought he'd just gone to the drugstore.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did the test flight accident happen?
I think Virginia.
Okay. How did your dad feel when that happened, do you know?
Devastated.
I'm sure.
But he was the one. He said, I'll take the coffin back.
Uh-huh.
He's the one that met with the family. His eyes were already, his eyes had always been bad, but he was tired of faking it.
Okay.
That's when he went into being a commander and stopped flying shortly after that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And what do you think informed that decision to stop sort of getting by?
I think that his eyes were going bad, and he missed Billy Tom, and he just knew that they were being reckless with lives. It's one thing to die in a war. It's another thing to die because they're making you fly machines that aren't safe.
Was that hard for your dad?
Yes, because at that time when they were testing those planes,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's right before Korea, it was like, you know, one out of seven pilots' planes blew up.
Right.
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just insane. It's like using these, you know, that's craziness.
About what year was that?
Mm-hmm. I would guess it has to be late 40s because I was born in 50
mm-hmm.
before I was born.
And were your parents still dating or still trying to see each other at this time? Or?
They were married in, I think, 48.
They got married in 48.
Okay.
Where did they get married?
In Virginia.
Okay.
And Newport News.
And your mother clearly understood that California then would be behind her.
I don't think so.
No. Okay.
I think my mother thought she was marrying a wild fighter pilot. And she said he picked her up in a station wagon and she should have known there had been a switch.
Okay.
Because Dad was ready to settle down.
Okay.
Mom was ready to party all night.
And so did she miss California then?
She missed, yeah. She missed California. She missed traveling. She missed parties.
Mm-hmm.
She missed working.
How did her brother's health end up?
He died.
Okay.
And in fact, my mom and Dad pretended to be married because it was my Uncle Russell who told my mom that there were lots of men who would love her, but that my dad was the only one that would. My dad's nickname all through high school, college, and the service was Sadie.
Sadie.
Sadie, S-A-D-I-E.
Okay.
Slick-eyed Sadie, because
uh-huh.
of the way he shot a basket.
Okay.
What can I tell you?
Okay.
That my dad was the only one that would love her forever. And so he said, my one wish before I die is that the two of you get married. He said, Jerry, I just want you to be married. You know, and taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pretended to be married. And then they felt, you know, they went ahead and got married. But they got married, military marriage in Newport News.
Do you mean a civil ceremony? Or?
Well, it was at the base chapel with,
okay.
you know.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
People in uniform and.
And people she didn't know. Really.
She knew some of them because she had partied with them. I mean, one of the people who helped throw it was one of my dad's ex-girlfriends.
Really?
Yeah, the
okay.
woman he dated when he went, you know, with
uh-huh.
my mom.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And did the two of them get along?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And so she's trying to settle down to the...
Be an officer's wife.
Different life, yeah.
Yeah, what a joke.
And it's a joke because...
She's totally ill-equipped to do it emotionally and psychologically.
Now, you said she might have wanted to keep working.
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if she knew. I mean, I know that she had had two jobs and been responsible. My mom was a perpetual party girl.
Uh-huh.
She was the first one up with Bloody Marys and the last one to bed with spiked coffee. You know, she wanted everything to be pretty. She wanted to decorate a home so it was pretty. She wanted everyone to be happy.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted your attention. And I totally believe she was bipolar. And would get depressed and would self-medicate with alcohol
mm-hmm.
and wouldn't talk about it. And so she'd say, oh, let's take a drive in a convertible, you know, or it'd be this sort of dramatic swings, or let's have a picnic out on the river, you know, and you're going, okay, here we, and it's all that's a lot of fun.
Right.
And then it gets really old, and I don't know if she ever knew what she wants. I know that she would tell me things like the day that my sister and I learned how to read was the worst day of her life.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
She thought she wasn't needed anymore.
Okay.
So it's that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's just, the military can be really hard
mm-hmm.
on women. Or, I don't know about male spouses now,
mm-hmm.
but on women it can be really, really hard.
And she was moved into officers' housing then?
Yes.
And did she have much interaction with other officers' wives? Did you know much about that?
She did, yes, and she hated it.
Really? Why?
Because she didn't play bridge. She didn't like the pretentiousness of it all.
Uh-huh.
She didn't like how they pulled rank when they weren't supposed to, and they weren't much fun.
They weren't much fun.
Well, because there was all this protocol. Protocol's not much fun.
Right, and did she know the protocol, or did she
Yeah, they give you a book. I have the book. Thank you.
Really?
Yeah, it's a book called How to Be an Air Force Officer's Wife. And it tells you, you know, you're supposed to leave a business card when you go to visit someone, and where your kids are supposed to play, how you're supposed to decorate your house, how, you know, the drinks you're supposed to serve, everything. I mean, she tried, but she knew it was crap. So she, you know, she bought and didn't have the ability to find a healthy outlet. She just drank.
Right.
You know, I mean, we would be the ones that would, she would have all the kids in the neighborhood at our house because that was more fun than being with the adults for her.
Mm-hmm. How long did they stay in Virginia?
Probably about a year, because my sister's 16 months younger, mm-hmm. and she was born in North Carolina.
Okay. What base were they at in Virginia, do you know?
Langley.
Okay. And they went down to North Carolina?
Went down to North Carolina to Charlottesville.
Okay. And was that a new appointment promotion for your dad? Or?
I think so. Okay. He must have been made captain by then, because okay. he was a captain when we were in Thailand.
Now that he's left the actual piloting and past mm-hmm. piloting, what is he doing? Do you know?
He did ground and air surface coordination.
Now, do you know what that actually means?
Yeah, it means how do you coordinate the use of air power and land power, and how do you get everyone to understand it and be on board?
Okay.
How do you get the commanders and all the way down to the lowest airman to get it, that it's all one thing, that you are going to be working with other branches of the service, mm-hmm. and you're going to be, how do you make that happen?
He was in North Carolina for how long?
Let me see, it would have been 1.5, not long, because we went to Thailand from North Carolina.
Okay, so he was never assigned to the Korean theater?
That's what he did in the Korean theater, with the land air
okay.
coordination.
When did he go out there? Do you know?
No, I don't know.
Was it brief?
Probably, because okay. he would have been coordinating. It would probably have been, he wouldn't have been fighting. He would have been someone figuring out how they're going to fight.
Okay, but you're not sure where he might have been based?
Yeah.
Okay. The assignment to Bangkok.
Yeah.
That came up in 1952.
Yeah, about that.
Okay. And do you know how your mom felt about relocating?
She talked about it as a grand adventure, and it was going to be harder than hell, because she had two little kids,
yes.
of four,
uh-huh.
and we were going to be there for almost 3 years.
Was it understood that you would be there that long in the beginning?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But she thought it was a great opportunity, and it was a wild adventure, and she packed us up. I mean, we all learned how to pack really well, and we went, got on a plane and went.
Uh-huh. You were very young.
Yes, yes.
And
I remember the plane ride, though.
Do you?
Parts of it,
wow.
yeah. We had to have an emergency landing in the Philippines.
Okay, that's memorable.
Uh-huh.
Do you know why?
Just one engine went out.
Okay. And your dad was flying along with you, the whole
yeah,
family together?
Yeah, dad went with us. We went from North Carolina, probably stopped off a couple places to see relatives, and then flew out of California.
Okay. And do you know how your father felt about this assignment?
He thought it was great.
Really?
He thought less about it when he got there. He loved the Thai Air Force. He admired the men, thought they were wonderful. Didn't really like living in Bangkok.
Now, what was his brief? What was he supposed to do?
Advisor.
To?
The Royal Thai Air Force.
Okay. And was his base of operations the U.S. Embassy, or was it?
I have no clue.
Okay.
The house we lived in
uh-huh.
was owned by the ambassador, and it came with 5 servants.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Can you describe it?
Only my brief memory that mm-hmm. it was big, mm-hmm. and that there were these people already living there, which turned out to be the servants,
mm-hmm.
and that it was usually kind of hot and steamy,
yeah.
and that there was all, there were people who came by, and we could get strange candy from it, which turns out to be sticky rice and mango.
Uh-huh.
And that it's the first time I knew my mom drank. And that dad was gone a lot, but it was kind of cool because we always had a baby eye, which is a babysitter,
okay.
with us.
Uh-huh.
So for me, it was a lot of play, but just back of my mind, consciousness of my mom's drinking.
And that meant to you that she wasn't available to you?
It meant to me that things were weird.
Things were strange.
Things were strange.
Uh-huh.
Things were just strange. She wasn't right. I mean, I didn't know what wrong was, but I knew she wasn't right. And I knew that Dad, we would still be put on alert and standby every once in a while, and everything would get kind of weird. I got real used to, if you're on alert or standby and you're independent, that things are strange. But
that's different.
That's different than your mom mm-hmm. acting weird and having kind of a floppy-looking conversation or something.
Okay, uh-huh. And what do you remember about your dad during this time period? Was he happy?
I think he was gone a lot. I think he was happy some of the time when he would come and come home at night and have a beer. I remember some happy things there and some adventures that we kind of had. You know, I remember we have films, films of like the Thai Air Force and address the helicopters like elephants and the flybys and, you know, the parades and all that. So, you know, he got sick once because he wouldn't eat. He insisted on eating the base food, and everyone said, no, you got to eat some of the native food or you'll get sick. He got real sick.
Did he really?
He got dysentery, yeah.
Right. Were you well while you were there?
Yeah. I didn't get sick till I got home.
Oh, okay. In general terms, do you remember, for example, your Aya? Do you remember her name?
My baby Aya?
Yes.
Let me think. Give me a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, because my mom wanted to adopt Boo. Her name was Boo.
Okay. And your mom wanted to adopt her?
Yeah, she was only probably 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
My mom wanted to adopt the whole damn world. I mean, she wouldn't let the cook because she'd beetle nut. I mean, you know, mom had all these servants that were being paid, but she wouldn't let them work. She let the lawn guy work. That's about it. You know?
Now, she didn't want them to work because she wasn't comfortable with it, or what do you think that was about? Because
they weren't. She didn't think they were sanitary enough. They
really?
They didn't sterilize things very well.
Okay, you mentioned the beetle nut juice.
Yeah, the main cook, you know, was always chewing beetle nut and spitting out juice and had black teeth. Mom didn't think that was real healthy for someone who did that to be cooker. So she kept her on, but she just cooked. You
know? And your mom did the cooking? Or?
Oh, she talked about it. I'm not really sure. I think that you eat a lot of fruits over there. I don't think you do a lot of cooking.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not as Hades over there. It's when you still have the clongs and you have the markets or open-air markets with hanging food.
Mm-hmm.
What I do remember is seeing the Buddhist temples and being drawn to the color of gold, saffron robes.
Really?
Of the monks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and the smell of incense mixing with frying chicken hanging from a rack.
Did you start to learn Thai?
Oh, we spoke Thai.
Did you?
Yeah, we just couldn't keep it up because of, we come back to the States and, you know, we weren't bright enough to know, God, this might come in handy 50 years from now.
But you basically were picking it up and...
Oh, sure.
And,
Yeah, you know, we'd say, you know, like, Nuat, which is mustache, and my D, which is bad, and Vingi Aiki, which is come here, and Gin Khao, dinner, and Soywadi, which is thank you. You know, I mean, we learn, you know, words that kids learn.
Sure.
And you don't even know you're learning.
Sure, exactly.
Yeah.
It's very easy.
Yeah.
And you were there for 3 years.
Yeah, just about 3 years.
How did your sister do? Did you guys kind of club together?
Oh, yeah, we were inseparable.
Okay,
We were like little twins. She loved it. I mean, she ran around naked all the time, and
right.
we learned Thai dancing from, you know, some of the young girls, and we just, you know, for us it was a grand adventure because we didn't have to pack or unpack. We just hung it, you know, we slept in the same big bed, and we were dressed alike and played dolls. She was totally unaware that Mom ever drank or anything.
Yeah, because she was too young.
Oh, yeah, and I protected her. I would never let her know that.
And how would you protect her?
I would just distract her attention.
Okay, so that kind of became your role?
Oh, still is.
I hear that family system thing.
Oh, yeah.
When you had to leave, do you remember leaving?
I remember just the trip home. I don't remember packing or anything. I remember that, you know, we came home by ship, a little bit by air, but mainly by ship.
Wow.
Through India, and, you know, Mom wanted to see Europe, so we made it around the world.
Wow.
I know. It's pretty amazing to grow up. I know you've been around the world by the time you're five.
Is that, was that something that your dad wanted to make sure your mom had?
I think he wanted it for us, too. I think he wanted it for all of us.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think he just knew that it's a once-in-a-life, you know, for most people, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. He didn't know anybody who had ever done it.
Right.
Well, I mean, we met people on the boat and all.
Right.
We were on that. Queen Elizabeth coming back from Europe, but we went up through, I can remember being in India because we saw different ceremonies around temples with snake charmers and all,
mm-hmm.
Parts of Europe, and, you know, we were just kids seeing stuff. You know, I want to go back to see it again.
Did you go through the Suez Canal?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And did your dad went with you on this whole
long trip?
Oh, yeah.
He was with us the whole time.
That's extraordinary.
Because we had diplomatic passport. That helped, too.
Okay.
And I'm not quite... See, this is the part. I'm not quite sure how a captain in the Air Force gets diplomatic passports. This is the first clue I had that something else might have been going on.
Okay. And I'm sure it probably was.
Yeah, me too.
When you arrived back in the States, what was the next assignment or billet or?
We were South Carolina, Sumter, South Carolina.
Okay. How long were you there?
I guess they first take you actually back to North Carolina, but we were briefly there. We were in Sumter, South Carolina until I was in the second grade. Because I had rheumatic fever in South Carolina.
You did?
Yeah. I came back to the States and promptly tried to cut my toe off on a bicycle, and then later on I developed rheumatic fever in South Carolina. So we must have been there about 2 or 3 years.
How long were you ill?
Well, technically I still have it. So,
yes.
But they put me in the hospital for 3 months, but I couldn't walk for 6.
Wow.
So I had a heart murmur. They caught it. Mom caught it because she knew it from her brother. But, she used it to blame me for the reason she was an alcoholic.
That she was so upset about your illness.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The perfect, denial. But my sister loved it because it meant we got a maid for my sister all day long. Because Mom was at the hospital with me.
So she had, personal
attention.
Oh,
absolutely. Yeah, undivided, and got, someone to play with her 24/7. I didn't go to kindergarten, so it must have been, right after we got back, because I never went to kindergarten. I went to first grade in South Carolina, and then we moved to Arkansas, to Blytheville.
What rank did your dad have at this time, do you know?
He must have been a major.
Okay.
So maybe he got to be major in Thailand, because he made lieutenant colonel in Arkansas.
Okay.
Because I remember the party when he made lieutenant colonel.
Okay. And so you were in Sumter for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay. And the assignment down to Arkansas,
yeah.
Was to what base? Do you remember?
It's now a defunct base called Blytheville Air Force Base.
Okay.
Later on they changed it to another name, but at the time it was Blytheville Air Force Base. And it was to open up a SAC base. That's when Dad changed to SAC.
Okay. And this would have been 1957?
Correct.
Okay. It was a base in the Strategic Air Command, and do you know what your father's general assignment was there?
Yeah, to open it up. He was going to be squadron commander of field maintenance, but he was to help open up the base. I mean, they picked a handful of men. It had been, I guess, some sort of training base during the war,
uh-huh.
and when SAC came into being,
uh-huh.
they picked a handful of men to open up a base, and he was one of them.
And he became a lieutenant colonel?
There.
Okay. At the time, roughly, that the base opened, or was it later
probably
on?
About 5 years after it opened.
Okay. And
maybe 4 years after it opened. He was one of the acting base commanders at the time. I was just getting my breast, probably about 12, I was 12 or 13, about 12, 11 or 12.
Okay.
About 61.
He was assistant base commander or acting?
Yeah, it was, when you're opening a new base and you're waiting for, we didn't have any generals on base, and we only had a few full birds, and so for a brief time we lived in a commander's, in a full bird house,
uh-huh.
instead of a lieutenant colonel's house,
Right.
And he was just an acting base commander, one of the three acting base commanders, and he knew it was a short assignment, but he did it anyway.
Okay. And over the time he was there,
mm-hmm.
Do you remember, for example, race issues being important?
Oh, duh. Could the movie Remember the Titans?
Yes.
That was our base. I mean, not really, but it could have been our base. My mom did volunteer work with the Red Cross. We were threatened. My sister and I had our lives threatened. My mom got crank phone calls threatening her and with threats like, I know where your girls get off the bus. They had a pretty ribbon in their hair today. Horrible threats. Mm-hmm. Turned out to be the lieutenant colonel that lived the next house over.
It was him?
Yeah. They bugged our phones because it's, you know, even the Air Force knew you can't be doing that shit. Dad had helped integrate the service. I mean, he'd been on one of the panels that helped do that. We had football games. Where other teams would threaten to cancel football games because we had black kids on our team. Because of our, you know, the base is integrated. Guess what? The school's going to be integrated.
Right.
The school's got to go along because military pays big bucks. Big bucks to have their kids go there.
Sure.
We show up one night at a game, and it's even before my little cheerleader, but we're there, and my dad has, you know, station wagon filled with kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to let us in because we have a black kid with us. My dad just, I mean, I remember this. I saw this. He just went up to the man in charge, principal of town, little mayor, whatever the hell it was, some little redneck.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you know, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Dudley S. Akins. I'm so-and-so at Blyville Air Force Base. If you don't let us in, as of tomorrow, your town and every shop in it will be off limits to all the men, women, and personnel.
Yeah, and that was probably effective.
Yeah, we got in.
Okay.
But, I mean, I was there. I heard him say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if he could have pulled it off, but I heard him say it.
Were you frightened that moment? Do you remember, or proud, or what feelings did you have watching this confrontation?
Well, I thought it was normal. I mean, my dad did shit like that all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was like, of course you did that. It is very difficult to describe the Deep South to someone who hasn't lived there,
mm-hmm.
because which I have my whole life outside of Thailand, I've been raised in the Deep South. You are engulfed in a society that perpetuates the notion that African Americans are happy, that they like it where they are.
Uh-huh.
So, truly, to the civil rights movement, when people go, "Are you blind?" You know,
mm-hmm.
you don't start to get it. You don't start to truly understand what a horrible system it was and is. And so, I think I would love to say that I never took part in something, little school taunting that would have been racist.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember one in particular, like, okay, would you rather fly down a razor blade? I mean, something horrible, or be kissed by a black?
Yikes.
And they'd use the N-word. You know, I mean,
right.
I'm sure that we all said things like that. I mean, I know we did.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what I learned from my parents is not to think that way, not to, you know, that's wrong. And so, racism was a huge, huge part of it. And it was so huge you didn't talk about it. I mean, probably the biggest gulf between money was a race, was a class issue. You know, no one stopped to think that you didn't want to hang out with what was called poor white trash, and the blacks were below that. I mean, it had as much to do with class. It's just that when the color of skin is so different, it's an obvious definer.
Do you think it was because you were a bit older that you remember this particularly about Arkansas, or did you have some sense of it before when you had been in South Carolina?
I didn't have any sense of it in South Carolina because I was a kid. I think it's because I was older.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had started thinking.
Right.
I think that because my mom started flipping out when we had all these threatening calls, my mom had a total breakdown, and we had a hospital, we had a committer to a mental hospital. That became pretty paramount in my mind.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I saw how it affected, later on, I realized how it affected my dad's career. I knew how it affected my life. And so it's just been burned into my memory. It's part of why when I teach about tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know what the kids said in the locker room. I know what they said behind people's backs. That it was just, you know, racism is an evil. Prejudice is an evil. It's an evil that's spread by whispers and looks. And you know, it's easy if it's an organized hatred.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy when it's a prevailing, you know, just always there, ominous thing that's just waiting.
And the calls that your mom particularly got,
mm-hmm.
And you said that they were generated by this lieutenant colonel.
Yeah.
What was What was the attack about? Was it about your father's policies? And if so, what were they?
It was actually about my mom's policy. She let a black woman sit in the front seat of the car.
Of her personal car?
Yeah. When we had maids, everybody always had maids on bases.
Sure.
But we always had maids. Women didn't work, but we had maids. I think it's a good idea. I want a maid. I actually do. I think it's a great idea. I want a maid. And she went out into the country with Red Cross and gave shots to poor people, including blacks, and never hesitated to do it and would touch their skin. And also because of my dad's policies, you know. I think it's a combination. I think we were targeted as liberals. You know, if you're a redneck, we were a pretty good target.
Your mom became interested in working with the Red Cross at what point?
Probably about then, because she and I were, you know, up in elementary school, and she wanted something to do, and it looked like something that would occupy her time. And
so she was out doing sort of public health?
Yeah. She was a volunteer at the hospital, and she would do public health stuff. You know, she'd go with the Red Cross and volunteer to drive people to give shots to little kids. She was really good with little kids. She'd take cookies and get them to get, you know, because no one got vaccines.
Right.
I mean, we forget how horrible it was. No one, they didn't have access to any of that. You had to take it to them. Well, you still do, actually.
Yes. And yeah. She was interested in doing that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah. You know, my mother had a great big heart, and she had no boundaries. And so that meant that at other times, I would come home from school, and this is the first big breakdown, and she would have brought a whole family in our home of very poor, trashy people, no other way to say it. And the kids were in my bedroom, my sister's bedroom, which is her bedroom, playing with all our toys, trying on our clothes. Mm-hmm. And the adults were in the living room with my mom, all passed out drunk.
Now, were these whites?
Yeah, these were white.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to call my dad from work. My dad's acting base commander. I had to call. I mean, we had the red phone in the bedroom that goes to directly to the packet. I just had to call Dad at his main office, which you did not do.
Right.
You did not. Mm-hmm. And say, Dad, you got to get here. Mom's asleep, and there are all these people in the house.
Do you remember that particular day that your
Absolutely.
Dad came home?
Yeah.
What happened?
He came in. He woke him up. He got all the people. He said, Jerry, stay here. He gathered up all the people, took them home. It would have gone maybe 30 minutes, you know. Got them off the base, came back, and my mom started throwing a fit, started, like, hitting him. And said, how dare you? They're my friends. And he said, Jerry, stop it. You know, this isn't right. You've been drinking, you know. And she wouldn't stop hitting him, so he cold-cocked her.
Really?
Yeah, knocked her out, put her in the car, and told me to take care of my sister, and he'd be back as soon as he could. And he drove her straight to Memphis, Tennessee, which is 45 miles away, and committed her to the military hospital for psychiatry or psychology, whatever.
Do you think he had this plan kind of already in his mind?
I think he... I
as a possibility?
No, I don't know. Maybe.
Okay. And how long was your mom away?
About 5 weeks. One of my aunts came out to stay with us.
Okay. Which aunt was that?
My Aunt Helen.
Okay. Was that a good thing that she came?
It's okay. She and my dad got along, and she's sweet. And then we went by train once to see my grandparents. So he sort of, you know, we were taken care of.
Okay.
It was burden having drunks in the house.
Was it?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these are people, I mean, they had lice, and they had boogers all over their face.
And it was chaos.
And you didn't know them. You'd never met them. You come in, and they're all these strangers, and they're drunk. All the adults are drunk in your living room, kind of laying on each other.
Was it kind of a breather for you in a way when
your
mom was out there?
Yeah, except for she came back and had to go to outpatient thing, you know, to see a psychiatrist there, and had to go on a bus with other men from the service. The military actually tries to help their people, and one day she didn't show up afterwards, and so Dad got home. He said, where's your mom? She hasn't come home from the bus yet, Dad. You know, I don't take care of you. I mean, you never lock your doors or anything, so that was no problem. And he said, okay, get in the car. We can go find her. And she was behind a little water service box, it's like a little shed, but it's made out of brick,
mm-hmm.
with the husband of my fifth grade teacher, and they have a bottle between them, and they're just back there drunk as skunks, drinking, sitting on the ground.
Wow.
Yeah, that was real fun.
No.
But that teacher really was nice to me after that. She really was. She caught me cheating and didn't turn me in and sent me stuff. You know, she just sort of knew.
Was all of this having impact on your behavior? You mentioned cheating, and were you starting to act out a little bit?
Yeah, but then I turned it around. I mean, my sister never really knew about it, so she ended up acting out for other reasons, but I just became a super good girl. I mean, I cheated on a spelling test because no one knew I was dyslexic.
Oh.
I didn't know I was dyslexic. You can't spell if you're dyslexic.
Right.
It's just, you're just going, but an E and an A are close. What is the big deal?
Right.
Just switch them.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'd tell my teachers. I'd go, it's only one letter. You can't count off the whole word for one letter.
How did that argument go down?
They laughed and marched off.
Uh-huh.
Because no one knew.
Right.
No one knew that it doesn't work for me.
Right. There was no such thing then.
Yeah.
It wasn't diagnosed.
Yeah, no, none of that was done. And so I just became a super good student. I became class officer cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I became a good girl.
You stayed at the base in Arkansas until 1964?
Correct.
Okay. Do you recall any other incidents during that time period? For example, do you remember the President Kennedy coming to office?
I remember him being killed.
What happened that day?
Things were shut down. First of all, they announced it at school, and it was panic. I mean, we didn't know what was going to happen.
Do you mean the students panicked or the teachers? Or
everybody. We all just cried. Nobody knew. Everybody was in shock.
Uh-huh.
You know, I remember grabbing my pom-poms and just sitting there going, what? What? You know, people grabbed things. I mean, they just held on to things. And we were sent home, and when we drove up on the bus, the flag was out. There was to be a red flag out, which meant you were on full-blown alert.
Okay.
And that meant you couldn't leave your house. You got off your bus, you went to your house, and you didn't leave.
So the red flag was out.
Oh, yeah.
Had you ever seen it out before?
Oh, yeah.
On occasions like?
Yeah, like the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And other, SAC always had alerts, but you knew. When you're on full alert, it means you don't leave your house, you don't make phone calls, and you have to be prepared to leave with one phone call.
Okay.
Because there was a mountain we were supposed to go to because we were number 3 on the list for being attacked.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
At the time?
Yes.
Do you know where the secondary base was, the bunker that you were supposed to go to?
Yeah, I wouldn't have known how to get there because I didn't know how to drive, but I knew it was up in the hills of Missouri. We were 3 miles from Missouri and 6 miles from the Mississippi River.
And you said that the base was on some kind of ladder chart for having to relocate, and they were number 3?
Yes.
And did your dad tell you all this, or was it in school, or how did you find out?
No, my dad.
Uh-huh. And did he kind of tell you, look, kids, we may have to move at so you got to be ready?
He told me.
Okay.
Yeah, because
you
I made the phone calls for him.
Okay. Uh-huh.
When we would have an alert, he would get a message, and it would be like, Colonel Akins, this is Lieutenant Brown, Broken Arrow. Dad would say, Roger, Broken Arrow. Click. And then he had a list that he called. And while he was getting dressed to go down there, he would say, Future, make these calls for him. When I got old enough, he knew he could trust me. And I'd say, this is Future Akins calling for Colonel Akins, Broken Arrow. And they would have to confirm. They'd say, correct, got you, thank you, click.
And you made these calls?
Absolutely. And then if one didn't answer, you called their list.
Okay.
You made sure the list was called. Oh, yeah. That was one of my jobs.
Uh-huh. And that day that you came home on the bus, the day of the assassination,
Dad was already at work. We didn't see him for a week.
And the base was basically tightened down?
Yeah, teen club was closed. Movies were shut down. You didn't go to a movie. You didn't leave.
Go ahead.
We watched TV, uh-huh. and Mom served us dinner and got drunk and said, eat this. It may be your last meal forever. Crap like that. I mean, she got no one. We were allowed to go to school. I mean, we went to school, but the whole base, there were no social activities except for church for a whole week.
Your mom saying this might be your last meal, what effect did that have on you? Did you believe her?
Partly. I also, by then, she was a drag.
Yes.
I drew. I got out my sketchbook and drew.
Was that your, that was your release?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What about your sister?
She watched TV and watched me draw, play with dolls.
Did you watch the events of that weekend?
No, we watched cartoons and
okay.
Something.
Okay.
I mean, we did see the funeral and all, but we didn't watch it 24/7 by any means.
Right. You didn't see your father at all for quite a while?
I don't remember seeing that for a week.
Okay. Do you remember when you did finally see him?
Yeah, but everything had sort of come out. It's kind of like, you know, come home from school one day, and an hour later he's there, and it's kind of like it's all cool. I mean,
the red flag is gone.
The red flag's gone. You know, you can see your dad. Yeah, you know, kids from military grow up, you just know. You know, it's like at 5 o'clock, if you're out on the base, and they lower the flag, and they're playing taps, you have to stop. You have to stop your car, you have to stop moving, and you have to look towards the flag and stop.
How did you do with that kind of discipline?
Excellent.
Did you like it?
I didn't question it
okay.
at the time.
Okay.
I mean, you just, you know, you grow up with it, and it's not until you have to get kind of older to even know there's, I thought everyone did that.
Yes, right.
You're kind of like, okay. You know, I mean, it was a big shock to become a civilian and realize not everyone stopped at 5 o'clock for taps. Yeah. you just don't even know it, anything else exists.
And what age were you when you left Arkansas? So that would be
1964. I was, 64. I was 14.
You were all of 14.
All of 14.
When you found out that you were going to move, you had been in Arkansas for quite a while.
Yeah, we had been there longer than you're usually there.
Were you upset?
No. When my dad knew it was going to be his last assignment, because he'd been passed over for full bird 3 times, so we knew it was going to be a 2.5-year assignment, so my dad retired.
Mm-hmm.
It was time to move. I mean, I had made homecoming queen, but I was a cheerleader. It was a good way to break up with my little boyfriend. You know, it was a new adventure.
At age 14, did you understand or know about your father's not having been promoted beyond lieutenant colonel?
Yes, I knew it. I didn't know what an impact that would mean on a person without a job. You know, I didn't know what it meant to a man supporting a family when the wife is dysfunctional and the 2 kids are in high school and haven't even started college. I didn't know what pressure would have been on him.
He had been up for review 3 times?
Correct.
Did you find out at some stage what the issues were there?
Yes. One is, early on, he had punched someone out in a bar because my dad was always opinionated about how it should be done and never afraid to state it. And some guy came up and kept pressing him in a bar and said, "Don't you agree with me? Don't you agree with me?" And my dad, you know, and witnesses, other people told me the story too. Dad said, "I don't want to talk about it in a bar. Let's leave work at work, and this is a bar. Have a drink. I'll buy you a drink." And the guy wouldn't leave him alone. And Dad finally said, "No, I don't agree with you. I think you're a stupid son of a bitch." You know? And the guy said, "Well, how dare you?" And swung at him. Well, Dad punched him out.
Sure.
You know? Well, the guy was ahead of him and, you know, ended up in the Pentagon.
Do you know who it is?
Nah. Dad never said.
Uh-huh.
You know, if he did say, he just told it as like, well, that was a stupid move.
But it was somebody who later had
had
a big impact.
Well, and then he had changed from TAC, Tactical Air Command, to SAC, and Mom was an alcoholic. There's a big gap between making Lieutenant Colonel and Colonel.
Yes.
And they're not, you know, they don't want to take on a man who has major problems at home because they don't think he can be focused. Plus, Dad never went to the academy and had no degree. But, I mean, he was of the school that he could have still made it, but it was getting to the point where one of those factors being off wouldn't have hurt him. But 4 of them, there was too many. You know.
Was the race issue part of it, too?
I don't think so, because by then the service was really getting... The service sort of led the way in integration.
Uh-huh.
And they would have promoted and championed my dad for that. But the fact that, you know, it was a known fact. My mom, by the time we went to Michigan, my mom had been committed to a mental institution twice.
Okay, so there was another episode.
Yeah, there was another episode.
Mm-hmm.
After that episode, another one. And so, yeah, I mean, you're just not going to, you know.
Future, can you tell me a little bit more about Lieutenant Palmer, who was your dad's assistant?
Yeah, he was wonderful.
And was he career as well?
Yes.
As lieutenant, it would seem so.
Yeah.
He was a gay man.
He was gay.
And how widely was that known?
I think it was widely known, and no one said a word.
Okay.
No one ever, I can remember a couple little, like, maybe fly remarks about it. But he was, as Dad said, he was such an incredible commander. He was such a gracious host. I mean, he did. His mother lived with him. So the way they thought about it is, well, he can't be doing anything if his mother's with him.
He can't be doing anything with
other men.
Okay. Uh-huh.
You know, that nobody said anything. Everybody knew and nobody said.
So there was an assumption kind of that he wasn't in a relationship?
Correct.
Okay. That he was basically a gay man who was not practicing.
Yeah, cloistered, not closeted, cloistered.
Okay. Uh-huh. And he was effective in his job, and your dad?
Absolutely. My dad totally relied upon him, and until his dying day bragged about him and said he never could have done what he did. They took the field maintenance squadron they inherited from the bottom to the top in a 3-year period.
Now, to the top in terms of efficiency?
All the ratings for the Air Force. Top of the Air Force.
And within SAC.
Yeah.
So that's
the top of the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what Palmer's career path was after you left?
I don't. Uh-huh.
Do you think that's somebody that your dad kept track of?
No. Because my mom overshadowed everything.
Was she becoming
a big issue
for your dad to make?
Yeah. Just an embarrassment, an issue, a concern. He just couldn't control her anymore, and he couldn't make excuses.
How do you think this affected him sort of personally? You said
it caused him to be overweight, which led to diabetes, which led to triple heart bypass. You know, I think it affected his health.
Okay.
I think it affected his ability to socialize and be with people because he never wanted to go out because of mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just hurt him. It broke his heart.
Could you seek that even as a teenager?
Not so much as a teenager because I was too pissed off myself.
Okay, but later.
Yeah, and he always defended her. It was later when I took care of him after his stroke. And he said, well, I'm trying to protect you. And I said, Dad, you think I didn't know? You know.
But you guys did get to communicate about this.
Later, yes, in the years I took care of him.
When you lived here in Lubbock.
Oh, yeah, when I came back, took care of him, yeah.
The move to Michigan, was that a good posting, or was it kind of a...
No, it was considered a hellhole.
Okay.
Because it was three major, it was SAC, CAC, and ADC.
We're all there?
Yeah, and that's never going to work. I mean, that's just like, everybody's going, okay, who's in charge? No one's in charge. What are we doing? And it was cold. It was cold and miserable. I mean, it starts snowing on Halloween, and it doesn't stop till Easter. I mean,
now, this is in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, it's by Sault Ste. Marie.
Okay, and the name of the base was?
Kinchlow.
Okay, and your dad had what position within SAC there? Do you know what
he was head of a squadron, but it wasn't field maintenance. It was something else. I don't know. He was the head of a squadron.
But it was a pretty not good posting.
He knew it wasn't a good posting. He told us it was going to be hard, mainly because it's gray. It's dark and gray and miserable. It's really depressed. I mean, you have a real morale problem, you know.
Right.
And it's damn cold. I mean, when you have alerts and you have to be out on the field or out on the, you know, on the airstrip, it's 20 below. You're freezing your bones off. It's horrible conditions.
At what point in the year did you go up there? This was 1964.
Halloween. We got there Halloween night.
And was it snowing? And did you go trick-or-treating that night or was
it? We just got to the officer's family quarters and then moved into our house that weekend or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the good thing about the military is you move fast.
Right.
And, I mean, we were at school by Monday. We left, I think, you know, Arkansas on a, God, we must have left, like, on a Friday, and we were in school Monday or Tuesday, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't miss much.
And that reload wasn't that tough for you, you said, that you...
It was interesting.
Okay.
I mean, it was always an adventure because you know no one. The good thing was my sister and I finally had bedrooms, separate bedrooms.
Uh-huh.
I always had dreams about it before I got there, so I was always kind of adventurous and ready. But, you know, no one. I mean, I came from being head cheerleader homecoming to nothing. You know, and so you have to make those adjustments. It was an extremely good school, great academic school. I'd come from a school in Arkansas, which is only below Texas in the ratings. And so I had to sort of do some catch-up. It was a bigger school, bigger base, and so they were just everybody dressed differently. They talked differently,
right.
You know, and they made out more. I mean, they were a little bit wilder. The women cussed and drank. And, you know, I was used to Southern girls who at least pretended they didn't.
And this was what year for you?
It would have been my freshman year.
Freshman year. And did you go right to high school?
Yeah, high school. Freshman year was considered part of high school.
And what high school was it?
It's called Rudyard High School.
Okay.
I just saw it 2 months ago.
Okay, I was going to ask whether you know if it's still there.
It's still there and thriving and actually much better off without the air base.
Because Kinchlow closed down. Do you know when it closed, roughly?
It closed soon after, within 5 years of us leaving, so it closed probably in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It's now 3 prisons.
There's a growth industry, huh?
Yeah, and the housing is all owned by the Sioux tribe. I didn't even know there were Indians there, but there are.
You lived there for 3 years in the Sioux St. Marie area and didn't know there were Native Americans there?
I lived on the air base, and I didn't know there were Native Americans. Absolutely, they're not going to teach you that.
Right, and you never met?
No, never met a Native American.
Or saw
they wouldn't have gone to the school.
The streets, right.
No,
did you go into Sioux St. Marie?
Yeah, we went about once a month.
Okay, can you describe the town?
When I went there, this is going to be tricky because I just saw it.
Mm-hmm.
When I went there, I remember it as a small little sort of one street town with some weird little shops in it that served small hamburgers. You know, you had to go to Canada to get really good woolens and to get good food.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And
do you remember the locks and the?
Oh yeah, we saw the locks. I remember tractor pulls with horses. You know, and tractors going at you. And a lot of country kids with 13, 14 kids, and they're big. I mean, the kids were big.
Yes.
They're built big.
They're
hardy.
Right. They're
hardy men.
Scandinavian, you know.
Hardy. I mean, they could, like, yeah, they could pull a tractor. A lot of, just, it's great. I just remember it being great. Sure enough, it is.
That hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed. You know, I think it's when I went inside myself in my mind and reading and art, and I just started, I just turned inward.
Did you have some encouragement for that at the high school?
A little bit. I mean, I took an art course, but I was by no means the best artist. I was just observing. What I did is I had my first serious boyfriend that was a senior, and I just lived in a dream world of kind of that relationship and the books I read and the music I listened to and doing art. But I did, you know, silly cartoons and caricatures. It wasn't serious art at all. I didn't need to.
But you were you were just starting out.
Yeah, I was just starting out. And I was just, you know, I probably spent more time learning how to give oral presentations and do research and stuff. I mean, I really liked school. School to me was a safe haven from home.
And it was a challenge, too.
It was kind of a challenge.
Uh-huh.
It
was different.
Yeah, because it was different. It wasn't. Languages were a little bit harder. Spelling would always trump me. I was always. I'd learned from my dad incredible lessons of how to study. He really taught me how to study.
Mm-hmm.
So even if something didn't come quick, I knew how to get it eventually. And he was very good at helping you with your talk. I was a very good presentator.
Mm-hmm.
And with doing reports, I could write a dynamite report.
So he found time to spend with you.
A little bit, but mainly it was just because I did the charts for him.
Right.
Yeah, and so I knew how to do one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I'd done them for him. I was like, oh, this makes sense. I can read this chart, you know.
How did you actually do in school there?
Oh, fees.
Academically. Uh-huh.
Couple fees. Uh-huh. Some A's.
Were there worries at all in the house when you
get
all
A's? I don't even know if they, no, I don't
they
even know.
They didn't pay attention that much?
Yeah, you were passing. There was never any pressure to be all A's. I never got in trouble for any low grades.
How was your mom doing during this period?
Not good.
Worse?
Worse. Uh-huh. She steadily, it would be drunk a month, sober a month. You know, she was just, and she started having grandma seizures again, and, you know, it got a little bit more embarrassing because it's harder to hide.
Well, was she medications, do you know?
Some, but not many, because she'd been taken off most, because they caused, military doctors can be great and they can be horrid.
Uh-huh.
She mainly had kind of horrid ones there. She was on some, but then they took her off and they caused more grandma seizures because they would, you know, she wasn't a very compliant patient.
I see. Okay.
And I just got pissed. I mean, I just started ignoring her. My sister actually became more of a caretaker for her because I just got bored with the whole thing.
You sort of checked out of taking care of her.
Yeah, I just was like, that's it for me. You know, we would have really good pizza parties for all our friends. Or I went to Sunday school every Sunday with my dad. And my mom and sister stayed at home, and that was kind of the dividing line.
Mm-hmm.
Mom and Z stayed at home. She slept in. Mom cooked fried chicken. Dad and I went to church.
Wow.
Well, he was a great Sunday school teacher. He was that's where I learned about philosophy and how to argue and stuff.
What church were you going to?
It's just a base chapel.
Okay.
Non-denominational
mm-hmm.
Christian.
Mm-hmm. So was it pretty much very few rules there, or at the chapel?
Well,
services,
rules in terms of organized religion.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Very few. I mean, you didn't have our biggest two debates were: is it sacrilegious to play "Jesus Loves Me" and dance to it?
Mm-hmm.
Was Jesus gay?
Okay.
Was Jesus married to Mary Magdalene?
Uh-huh.
And who cares?
These are quite contemporary sounding debates.
Yeah,
and this
yeah,
is,
no shit.
60s.
It was great.
Yeah.
One of my best friends in there, who's still a wonderful friend, would always ask, blind faith, what the world is blind faith? I want to see it. Show it to me. And I'd argue with him all the time about it. So we'd go off on based on blind faith. Dad loved it. We loved having him for a teacher because it was like freedom for him and freedom for us because we didn't have to read little books and recite
right.
verses and all that.
And kind. You got to know a different part of him, maybe.
Yeah. By that point, we'd started going to family reunions in June. We'd come down to Texas. And I realized he was like the rebel of the family.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, Dudley Do-Right is the rebel. You know, God, give me a break here.
Right. But did it make him seem kind of cool?
Yeah. Well, what I found out is that he was probably the most respected member of the whole family, among the men and the women.
Mm-hmm.
That it's an interesting process to learn that your dad was a hero in more ways than one.
Right.
You know, I mean, it really is. And he would tell you that, I don't know if it was because of the military or if it because the military fit him so well. You know what I mean?
Right, which came first. Is on
yeah, but it was a great match. It was a good match.
Future, let's take a break now.
Okay.
This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University. I'm continuing my interview with Future Akins. The date today is Tuesday, the 13th of January, 2004. I'm in the interview room in Special Collections Building at Texas Tech, and Future is at her home here in Lubbock. Future, you were going to tell me something in addition to what you had already said about your aunt, whose name was also Future.
Uh-huh.
She was a performer.
Yes.
Can you tell me some more about how she got interested and a little more about her career? You said she had been in the USO show.
Well, I think she got interested because she was a show-off. I mean, you know. I mean, the truth is, my grandparents were sort of distant, and she was next to the youngest, and growing up, she was an awkward, overweight redhead, and people made fun of her, and she was determined to get out from under the shadow of my mom, who was always quite pretty, and her way of doing it was sort of acting out, and she did. She dropped out of school at 17 and went to California. My mom was already working for the phone company there.
Mm-hmm.
Started working at the phone, not the phone company, but it was I still can't remember, an airplane manufacturer, Douglas.
Douglas? Okay.
Douglas. Uh-huh. And started working there and had a growth spurt. I mean, she'd tell you she was 5'11 and 3/4". She was 6 feet tall. When she wore heels, 3 or 4 inch heels, she was extremely tall, redheaded, big busted. Uh-huh. I mean, she stopped traffic.
She was a good-looking gal then, just like your mom.
Well, she wasn't. The truth is, my mother was a natural beauty. My uh-huh. mom's the one that everybody would go, oh, my word. My aunt knew how to make herself.
Got it.
Because of the way she dressed. And she got into showbiz. I mean, she got into acting, and she could sing and dance. My mom had been taught tap dancing.
Okay.
In Lubbock,
uh-huh.
and so my aunt could do that. So she got into USO shows, and because you get a lot of attention and you can date and you know.
Now was it all that in Southern California?
It was there, and then let me see, you know, I've never known the truth about her journey, but I know she worked for a while in Miami because there was a connection between Miami and New York City. She eventually went to New York City because that's where you would go if you were in steady acting.
Sure.
And she was a model in New York City, which was really hard because she had to, like, tape down her breast and, you know, not eat at all
mm-hmm.
to be so skinny. I mean, it's the first time I heard about speed, you know, was you took these pills so that you wouldn't eat and you'd be skinny. But she and her roommates would walk, like, Fifth Avenue on Sunday and stop traffic. I mean, their deal was they'd get dressed up to the nines.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is, their expression. And they were all 6 feet tall, and then with heels on, they were like 6.5 feet tall, you know, and they would literally get New York cops to stop traffic for them. And so she had all these terrible lessons for me about how a real woman never has to buy a meal or pay for a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you have to rent a mink stole, you do, but you always drag it on the ground behind you like it doesn't matter.
Okay.
You know.
was she an influence in any way? Did you have much contact or know about her?
She was an influence in the sense that I never wanted to be like her.
Okay. Did you know what she was up to when you were young? In the
mid-50s? Sort of. She was exotic. I mean, our life was pretty exotic. But she would come, she would sort of fly in for these visits. And
uh-huh.
she had been studying with Strasberg, so she would have us do dream interpretations and
Now, by Strasberg, you mean Lee Strasberg?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And so she'd have, tell me what it feels to be a leaf, the last leaf on a tree falling. And would have to do interpretive dancing to that and tell her our dreams every morning and then act them out. She would dress up like a gypsy and tell fortunes to all our little kids in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
She'd bake a cake. She wasn't a very good cook, and it would come out lopsided.
Right.
And so she'd put blue and green icing on it, call it waterfall.
She sounds wonderful.
She was. She was a great aunt. Terrible mother. I mean, she had a son. Terrible mother.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not a very good wife. But an insane, wild human being who had her own demons. I mean, there were times she was addicted to speed. And, you know, I spent some time a couple weeks in Jamaica with her best friend and learned a lot more about the demon side of her life.
Now, when was that trip to Jamaica?
I'm thinking, probably 6 years ago, 5 years ago, 5 summers ago.
You mentioned that she had married a number of times.
She married, her first husband was Paul Clark,
okay.
of Coates and Clark, as
okay.
in the thread.
Mm-hmm. So he was an heir to the
fortune.
Oh,
he had, yeah, money. But he was insanely jealous. And so she divorced him because she couldn't handle, and walked away with nothing but the clothes on her back.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't handle his jealousy and his, you know, and he ended up killing himself in a closet. I mean, literally going in a closet and shutting the door and killing himself and waiting for someone to find him. He was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Then she, was, you know, doing a little bit of acting and some modeling and married her second husband, who was Pierre Diadesky, the son of the French ambassador in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Playboy, they ran a beach in Haiti called Kayona Beach. It's now owned by the government.
Mm-hmm.
It's where my cousin Fulton Pierre Diadesky was born. But Pierre was a playboy. I mean, he was a playboy when she married him, and he was a playboy after she married him.
Did she live with him in Haiti?
Oh, yeah. She lived in Haiti for probably 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
And then they would come to Lubbock. I mean, she had Fulton in the States
uh-huh.
so that he could be an American citizen.
Yes.
And then she brought Fulton here, and we kept him on the air base in Arkansas for a while so that his father couldn't kidnap him. And then he came to live here in Lubbock with my grandparents, and Pierre and some of his friends from Haiti came and kidnapped him, because my aunt had kidnapped him out of Haiti. Which is in the day of, it was under Papa Doc, and if she'd gotten caught, she would have been killed.
Now that's Papa Doc Duvalier.
Yes.
Okay. And was Pierre sort of hooked up with the Duvalier clan?
Oh, in the sense that his parents were the French ambassadors and they were wealthy.
Okay.
I mean, you know, he was French. He was a white diplomat in a black country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, mm-hmm. yes, they knew he was horrible. They knew it was terrible. They were all afraid of him and his, what do they call it, police? They had a name for the police, some form.
Tom-toms.
Tom-toms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
From the tom-toms. And so, but they ran a resort for wealthy people from New York to get quick divorces.
Okay.
And they had some of my aunt's friends who were showgirls were always invited to be on hand.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense.
To console the newly divorced.
And now, did you say that Pierre and company
yes.
from Haiti
came to Lubbock?
They
Texas.
Came to Lubbock, and what year would that be?
Oh God!
I mean, do you have any idea?
Yeah, let me think. He's 5 years younger than me. He was about six, so I would have been about 12. So I'd been about 62.
And they made a flying visit here in
they made
of
a flying
of...
visit. They had my grandparents in the living room. Pierre just talked to my grandparents about, I just want to see my son. That's all I want.
And Fulton was living here.
He was living here with my grandparents.
Yes.
Because my dad said, I'm not going to raise this kid unless you let me adopt him.
Now, this is after he had been with you in Arkansas for
yeah,
a while?
Yeah, for about a couple of months.
So your dad actually had to say, I cannot raise this child.
Unless you let me adopt him, because you'll come in and you'll take him away. And
I see. And she did he say that to Future?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
He had no, I mean, my dad. She may have been 6 feet tall, but dad didn't care. You know, he was like, these are the rules.
Right.
And so while they were talking to my grandparents, mm-hmm. the two henchmen found Fulton in the backyard and got him in a car and took him to the airport, and they flew off.
And where did they go, do you know?
Haiti, Port-au-Prince.
How did they get there? Did they go through Miami, or?
Yeah, they had family in Miami.
What happened to Fulton?
He was raised in Miami, or in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and then Pierre and my Aunt Future sort of worked it out, and he was literally raised between Port-au-Prince, Miami, and New York City until his mother died when he was 13.
And then what happened to him?
He went and lived with his father in Miami.
In Miami?
By that time, yeah, they had given up the property in Haiti.
I see.
Although he still has relatives in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he goes, and he speaks Haitian, and, you know.
And do you have a relationship with him?
Yeah, I have a really good relationship with him.
Wow.
I'm the closest one to him. Because he's like a little brother.
Yeah, he sounds like an interesting
It's been really
man
hard
as well.
On him. He's
yes.
extremely dyslexic, you know. I mean, can you imagine coming to Lubbock, Texas, and telling people that you slept with whores in Miami? Or in Port-au-Prince. They don't even know where Port-au-Prince is.
Right.
You speak a language.
Or Haiti.
Yeah, you speak a language that sounds like Spanish but doesn't.
Right.
You know, right. You've seen voodoo ceremonies. Your other side of the family is Catholic diplomats.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in Lubbock, Texas on a farm. You know, they called them liars. They called him a liar. He'd come down from New York City and talk about going to PS 111 or something. And they'd call him a liar. It was a horrible life for him.
Yeah, it sounds tough.
It was.
And,
you know.
Like the fish out of water in a way.
Well, and then, you know, he got to see his mother in Hollywood right before she died of breast cancer. And you know, her parting gift to him was to get him laid.
That was her parting gift to him?
Yeah, she said, I'm not going to be around. I want to see how to smoke dope, drink booze, and get laid.
At age, he was how old?
13. She wasn't a very good mother. She was a great adventure. She's a mother you need to have when you turned 18. I mean, she's the type of person you should have gone to visit when you were 18.
Right.
And then learn things like that. Although, I would have been in art museums anyway, so down there.
And she married again after
She
Pierre.
Married Ed Water, who's a actor to this day. He's a character actor. He's in movies and on TV all the time. And
can you name some of the films that he has been in?
Well, the one that most people recognize him from, he was one of the guards in The Longest Yard.
Mm-hmm.
He was recently in Seabiscuit. He's on all the series. He usually plays a cop or a fireman. He's been on Third Watch and New York City, you know, all those.
ER?
I don't know if he's been on ER.
CSI?
He's been playing fire chief lately.
Yes.
And I haven't seen him. I saw him on Third Watch and then in another one. I can't remember.
And he's been acting for many, many years.
Oh, yeah. He was 17 years younger than her.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and he had been a stand-up comic, and they met, and they fell in love. And he came out here. He'd never owned a driver's license, raised in New York City. He thought we were all wealthy because we owned land.
Now, when you say he came out here, do you mean he came to Lubbock?
Yeah, he came once with my Aunt Future on their way to California to Lubbock. And
okay.
He bought, this is the funniest thing, for his first audition for a movie, I can't even remember which movie it was, he bought his Western clothes at Jack Davis Western Wear here in town and went around, like, taking a little recording of people's accents.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He went around with a tape recorder?
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And whenever he plays a colonel, he always emulates my dad.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's an actor. So
did he tell you that he's
yeah.
emulating
oh, yeah.
him? Do you have any kind of relationship with him at this
no,
point?
No. He came once after my Aunt Future died, because
mm-hmm.
it was shortly after that both my husband died and my grandmother died, and it was just too hard for him.
I see.
I've written him a couple of times. Fulton has talked to him a couple times, but
mm-hmm.
he's remarried to another actress and has another family. And
mm-hmm.
It was too hard. He can't do it.
Your aunt, did she, as you grew older, did she continue to see you? Or?
Oh, yeah. She would fly down and see her. She was crazy. I mean, she was wonderful. She would send Christmas gifts with no names on them because
uh-huh.
you had to find them by the vibration.
Okay, and can you explain what you mean by that?
As best as she did,
uh-huh.
she would just wrap them all differently and should say, find the one that you like. I mean, find the gift that looks like it's yours. Because they were all sort of weird little gifts, like candles that floated in water. And I mean, none of them were specific for anyone,
mm-hmm.
but she would just say, just, you know, and she knew they were all silly gifts. She would just say, you know, find a package that looks good to you, and that's yours.
So you were supposed to key in on some level to what was inside.
Oh, she was thinking, I don't know, either that or she didn't want to be accused of making the decision. I mean, you know, she was great fun. My friends loved her because she could out drink and out smoke all of them. You know, and she would sing beautiful Broadway songs. And this, at some point, my cousin Fulton, I guess he's about 12, because
mm-hmm.
this was before she had breast cancer, decided that he wanted to be baptized, you know, wanted to be like his buds. And so we went to a little tiny Baptist church, and they were singing some hymn, you know, in a, I think, crackly little voices.
Mm-hmm.
And my Aunt Future, you know, starts bellowing it out as if it was a Broadway production.
Was that here in Lubbock or in
oh,
New York?
Oh, yeah.
It was here.
Uh-huh. I can't remember. It's on 50th Street, a little Baptist church.
50th Street and?
Close to Q. I'd have
okay.
to look it up.
Okay.
Some little Tabernacle Baptist Church.
Wow.
She just, like, belted it out.
Uh-huh. And would you say that was, again, her, some kind of attention-getting?
Oh, yeah.
Or?
Well, I think, one, she hated bad people who couldn't sing for shit. And she could sing. I mean, she could really sing. She okay, this is the other story that is one of my favorite Aunt Future stories.
Uh-huh.
When my mom and dad were first married, and they were in Langley, my aunt would come down from New York City to visit. And what she would do is she would put on a leopard skin bikini.
Uh-huh.
She would go to the highest diving board. And, of course, she gets everyone's attention. She's 6 feet tall, leopard skin bikini,
right.
red hair.
Right.
Well, but they think, oh, she's just going to jump in and act silly. They didn't know she was a diver.
She
would do a swan dive.
How did she learn to do that? She...
Oh,
was it out in California?
Yeah, out in California, uh-huh. and when she worked in Miami, because she was a swim,
oh, right.
synchronized swim person.
That's right. Uh-huh.
And she didn't know all the divers, but she could do a couple dives, one a jackknife and a swan dive, you know.
So that got attention.
Oh, duh, you know, huge boobs, bikini, and she'd come out of the water like some vision, and Dad said literally she had to pick of any officer on the base, and she would pick one. One
really?
Single little pilot person and have a grand weekend with them. And then would fly home. You know, and Dad, you know, periodically the different officers would come to him and say, isn't it time for your sister-in-law to come? And so, I mean, she would get my dad. She's the only person I know that could get my dad singing Body Air Force songs.
Which he knew a few of.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But he was always so straight around us, but she would get him. And he would recite Rupert Brooke poetry.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think she brought out in your dad?
His younger days before he had to worry about my mom.
Okay.
I think he, by the time I was conscious of what all was going on, you know, when you're past being just a kid.
Yes.
He was so worried about mom and her acting out and her drinking. He didn't have time to have fun. I mean, he just,
right.
He really didn't. And so what my Aunt Future brought out of him was a couple of hours of, you know, hey, Sadie, you used to be a fighter pilot. We had a grand time, you know.
Let's talk about your dad for a few minutes.
Sure.
How did he get the moniker of Sadie, do you know?
Yeah, playing basketball.
Okay.
Because he had one really good shot, and they called him a slick-eyed Sadie.
And do you know what the origin of that phrase is?
Nope, just the Texas thing.
The Texas thing? Okay.
Some slick-eyed Sadie. I'm sure it probably has to do, I don't know. I actually don't know.
Okay. That'll be one for someone else.
Yeah, someone I never. I just knew that I didn't even know his name was Dudley till we went to family reunions. I mean, because they all called him Dudley.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, who are they talking
right.
to?
And so you kind of knew that you knew in some way that his first name was Sadie, not really Dudley.
Well, his initials were DS.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I technically knew, but all the people on the base called him Sadie or. We actually called him Colonel.
Right, I'm sure. What was his middle name?
Stevenson.
Okay, was that a family name?
Not that I know of. I mean, he his dad was William, I can't remember his middle name, William something Akins. I think William Wiley Akins, but William Akins. And his mother was Wiley Duranta.
Duranta?
Duranta.
How do you spell that?
D-U-R-A-N-T-A, Duranta.
Okay.
I just think they ran out of names.
And Stevenson?
I just think that they heard it somewhere because it was spelled with a P-H. I mean, he was the 13th kid.
Is that right? It was spelled P-H.
Yeah, okay. S-T-E, yeah. So, I mean, you know, that's 26 names that had come up with.
That's right.
That's a lot of names. And you know, they had Wiley and Cullen and Hattie, Hetty. Edna, Helen, Gladys, William, you know, Cullen, George.
They were kind of scraping the bottom of
it. I think they were scraping the bottom when they came to Dudley.
when you were talking yesterday about your dad's having had an assignment when he was a fighter, we talked about him as having been in Panama.
Yeah, but he's actually in Guatemala.
He was in Guatemala. Have you recalled anything more about that? Assignment
oh, no, except for that, you know, he actually loved to travel then. Outside of that, he was anxious. They really thought the war was coming near. I think that when it didn't come near, that's why he changed to reconnaissance. I mean, he wanted to be somewhere where you could be, where you were in the action. He was a typical young man that thought he was, you know, could do anything.
Right. Skipping forward to when your dad was up at Kinchlow Air Force Base in northern Michigan, up in the Upper Peninsula,
yeah.
That assignment was his final one within the Air Force, and that was from 1964 to 1967?
Correct.
During that time, although you were very young still.
I was in high school, yeah.
And you were pretty remote. Do you remember much about the escalation of the Vietnam conflict and any opinions that your dad might have had about that?
Well, there was two ongoing opinions. First of all, it was a really tough time for base kids.
Why was that?
Well, because it was our dads who were going to go to war.
Okay.
I mean, and you were old enough to know what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
It also meant your boyfriends were going to go to war.
Okay.
So, you know, there were guys graduating, and it was before Tet. There were guys graduating and going to war. And so you had friends. I mean, base kids, you may have one class, but you're really all mixed.
Okay.
Because you're the base kids against the town kids.
Uh-huh.
And so you knew of people who were going to war already. And you knew fathers who went. And that's how it was. So when people, Dad had two opinions. One, it's the only war we got, which is a sort of standard military bravo type crap.
Yes.
And anything that says peace is our profession is, you know, and it talks about fighting, you know, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go into all that. And the other one was, he just kept saying, this is a stupid war.
What do you think he meant by that?
I think he thought that Korea hadn't ended well.
Okay.
And he saw it as a remake of Korea, and that it was going to get us nowhere, because he didn't believe in demilitarized zones. He didn't believe in lines you couldn't cross. He believed if you were fighting, you fought till it was over. But you didn't have these rules about, you can't go here.
Right.
If the enemy's there, that's where you go and you kill them, or you take them capture, whatever. You don't have these stupid rules about. And he just thought it was killing people.
Do you remember your dad as having opinions, for example, about the firing of MacArthur when he posited the idea of putting U.S. troops into China during the
Korean War? Oh, my dad hated MacArthur. He because of Corregidor and Billy Tom, and he had heard from Billy Tom, his cousin Billy Tom Aikens.
Right.
How MacArthur had deserted the men. I mean, and Billy Tom, the only thing that Dad said Billy Tom ever got livid about was MacArthur.
And so when Truman fired MacArthur in 1951, there was no love lost there? Your father didn't
probably
feel
not.
Badly.
I can't imagine. I was only 1 year old, but I can't imagine he would have, because he had already knew what Billy Tom felt.
Right.
And that was his first. You know, he was going to believe Billy Tom over any politician.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so, in terms of the Vietnam conflict, your father felt that the kind of political constraints on
he
the
didn't
prosecution
think that,
were
yeah,
problem.
He didn't think that war should be fought by politicians. I mean, he just thought that they didn't know what they were doing, and that it wasn't, he didn't understand why we were doing it. I mean, he on one hand would say it's the only war we have,
mm-hmm.
and he could spout that, you know, we're stopping the communist tide. But by then he had seen enough war. What he would say is, the only people who want to go to war are those who have never been.
Right, which did not include him.
Right,
he had seen service.
He had seen service, mm-hmm. and his family had seen service, and he was like, the only people who want to go to war are the ones who've never been. And so he thought it was bullshit. But he knew it was his duty to do it. And so, but he also knew he wasn't going to be called because he knew he was retiring.
Right. But he did know people who were going to be
absolutely
called.
Absolutely, he knew people who were called.
And probably from Kinchlow Base.
Absolutely.
Did you know anyone in your high school who was became part of military service and went to Vietnam?
Yeah, it was a strange mixture. Some, it's like some of the kids, I guess it's maybe a pretty normal mixture. Most of us were going to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
A couple wanted to go to the Air Force Academy. I mean, they wanted to be career officers. Most people didn't. We just wanted other opportunities to be in the military.
Now, this is speaking of the dependents. Okay, kids of military
yeah.
service.
We did know that if you went in, you didn't really want to be an enlisted person, because rank has its privilege.
Yes.
Although some people did, because they couldn't make it in college, and, you know, you didn't have deferment, or they thought it was their patriotic duty. I had most, with the encouragement of their fathers, it was to avoid Vietnam. I mean, they weren't going to be conscientious objectors nor desert, but they... It was, I think father's father took the time to explain how really shitty war can be.
Yes.
And we were at first more concerned with our dads. We really were. But yeah, I knew, I know I did because I've seen the names, but mainly it was about avoiding all that, going to college.
For example, you had said earlier that you were dating someone in the last years that you were there
mm-hmm.
in Hinchlow. Do you remember that guy's name?
Yeah, his name's Bill Blazer. He's a lawyer in Arizona.
Okay. Was Bill concerned about...
No, because he knew, he had really hurt his knees playing football.
Okay.
And so you would never have, even though he was a great football player and went on to play college football at San Francisco State,
uh-huh.
he wasn't going to be drafted. They wouldn't have drafted him because of his knees.
I see.
And he knew he was going to college. I mean, everyone I knew was going to college.
Right.
And that was your college deferment.
Were you, how did you feel?
It changed.
Okay.
I was raised to be a Republican.
Uh-huh.
And when we first moved to Lubbock, this would have been the summer of 67,
mm-hmm.
there was a pro-America war, march. And I can remember making picket signs with my sister, and we marched down Broadway in a pro-America march.
And was that inspired by the events in Vietnam?
It was the 4th of July.
Okay.
4th
mm-hmm.
of July, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was probably within a year. What changed me was Kent State.
Okay. Before we get to Kent State, let me ask you about that march. Did you participate in that willingly, or was it kind of your dad's idea, or how did that come about? Do you remember?
Actually, I don't know. I think it's my sister and I. She
okay.
had a little boyfriend that wanted to do it.
Okay. And you had not been back in Lubbock very long.
No, we did. You know, it was new friends, and
right.
actually, her boyfriend is now the head of the food bank.
That would be the South Plains Food
yeah,
Bank.
Yeah, David Weaver. It was his idea.
Okay.
I can blame him.
Okay.
And so, I mean, I think we just wanted to do something. We were still had ties to the air base here, although Dad had never been stationed here. We went to Sunday school at the air base, and we shopped at the commissary.
Mm-hmm.
Because we it's really, really hard going to civilian life.
Have you graduated high school?
No,
okay.
I finished up high school here. I went a year and a half here. I went halfway through my junior year and my senior year with kids who had been together since
right.
kindergarten. It was really hard. Who had never been out of Texas. Hell, they'd never even been out of Lubbock, most of them.
How was that adjustment for you?
It was hideous. It was horrible.
And why?
Because they were idiots.
Now,
I mean, the school system was so much. Texas doesn't have a good education system.
Mm-hmm.
I came from one of the best in the nation. Michigan has excellent education.
Yes.
I came to Texas that doesn't. So they were redneck, they were prejudiced, and they didn't know how to transfer my grades. They didn't know how to look at my grades and figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they couldn't, I ended up taking a lot of art courses, government and art.
Now, when you say the kids were kind of idiots and prejudiced,
yeah.
Did you see much racial division amongst kids in Lubbock then?
Oh, yes.
Can you describe
some of
that?
I went to Coronado High School. We had one black student out of 3,000.
Okay. And do you remember that student's name?
It was a young girl, no, because she was in a class two grades behind me, and, you know, I barely knew people in my classrooms.
Uh-huh.
But I remember that they wanted to put on Snow White as the school play and have her be Snow White, and everyone freaked.
Everyone thought that was, what, hilarious or outrageous or...
I don't know. They thought they just weren't going to let us do it. I got called in
mm-hmm.
for putting daisies on. I did a lot of posters for, you know, different sports events and stuff.
Sure.
Because I, even though I had come in here late, I ended up making student council because they put me in the thug, druggy homeroom because I had a northern accent. They didn't know what to do with me.
So they put you in the druggy homeroom?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And because they were all so drugged up, they voted me for student council.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to be on student council. And so I did all these posters, and I put daisies on them, and they decided that was hippie communist stuff, so I had to take them all down. I got called in once because my hair was too long. Or my hair.
Your hair was
my
too long?
My hair was too long. I had the word bitching on my notebook, the surfer term bitching.
Uh-huh.
Got in trouble for that. You know, I mean.
You were just way different.
Oh, yeah.
And similarly, the young African-American girl that you're talking about was also probably
Oh, yeah. They had barely, you know, started letting blacks flip past Avenue A.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Avenue A was the demarcation line for African-Americans, where literally you could not live past Avenue A.
Now, do you mean west of Avenue A?
Correct, if you were African-American.
Okay. Was what this was some kind of unofficial ordinance?
Actually, I think it was an official ordinance.
Okay. And the period that we're talking about, 1967, 68?
Yeah, I don't know when they actually got rid of the law, but, the, you know, people... Look at the population today. I mean, it's it's still East Lubbock.
Right, and that means African American.
Yeah, yeah.
And what high school was over on that side?
Dunbar.
Did Coronado ever play Dunbar in sports?
No, because Dunbar was a grade less. You know, like we were 4A and they were 3A.
Okay.
Also, they were afraid to play Dunbar.
Okay.
They didn't want to play Dunbar. They were terrified.
Because.
They were black and bigger.
And they might win?
Yeah.
Okay. Was there also some kind of underlying sort of racial tension that might explode if black and white teams in the same city confront?
You know, I don't know. I mean, Coronado was, at that time, the wealthy school. I mean, there was just the day that new cars came out, there'd be half a dozen of them in the parking lot.
Wow.
Our annuals were late one year, so a girl had her daddy take his private plane and go pick them up for us. I mean, there was... There was some poverty there, but what you saw was the newest school in town and a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And for all that money, there were a couple people who really tried to be nice, but most of them, I was so different, and they had known each other so long.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Nobody was equipped to deal with someone. They didn't know what to do with me.
You, on the other hand, had adapted through several changes.
Oh, yeah. Really, this was my third high school.
Right.
You know, and I was like, okay, takes me about, you know, 2 days to figure out what the local style is.
Uh-huh.
I noticed the boys wore a lot of white socks. That was kind of weird. You know? And then I was like, God, white socks.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I can deal with that.
Uh-huh.
Because they just dressed differently up north. And, you know, girls didn't wear knee socks down here because it wasn't cold enough.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And was there... Within the high school, a kind of, socioeconomic pecking order where you had...
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Can you describe some of
that? Yeah, people who live in the Rush District, which is north of 19th and south of 4th Street, who had homes that looked like mini mansions, were cheerleaders and student council. And they ran the school, and they were the ones who were class favorites and had been... Since junior high, they were the same cheerleaders since junior high. They were the same ones voted for whatever, teen of the month. They got the classes that now would be called advanced placement. I mean, yeah, it was all geared for them.
Was there any awareness in this fairly insular group of young people that you're describing about the escalation of the war?
They were probably all pro. I mean, some of my, I would say that. It didn't take me long in art classes to meet people who would have not been for Vietnam.
Got it.
But, you know, if you have money, you weren't going to go to war.
What do you mean by that?
You were going to go to college.
Okay.
And you were going to get a college deferment. If you came from a lower middle class or a poor family, you probably couldn't go to college.
And so your chances of...
It depended upon your draft number, but yeah, that was a real fear. And so, yeah, I had a number, I can remember a number of young men. James Schultz, who's made this new battle of it, went to Vietnam, did his whole tour. I mean, you know, people who had to go and just sort of doughy-eyed. And all the stories about, you know, tell them you're gay, tell them, you know, eat this, be real bright, take this drug, you know. This will work, I promise you, kid. Well, the kids didn't have to worry about it.
Was there a kind of grapevine of advice like that of how to get out of physicals or how to get out of...
Oh, sure, sure.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I think, I didn't pay much attention because as a girl I didn't have to worry about
it. Sure.
But it would be you're just here about mainly you could tell them you were gay or you had to act like you were really crazy.
Okay.
Or you had to be underweight, so don't eat anything for like the week ahead of time, mm-hmm. Or tell them you do drugs. But then you were worried because they might send you to jail. In those days, in Texas, you might get 40 years for a joint.
For a joint of marijuana?
Yeah.
And what about the tell them you're gay? What would be the impact of that?
They wouldn't accept you. And, you know, all your friends would know you were gay, and so you didn't care. You just didn't want to be in the Army.
Did you ever know of anybody who tried that?
No. I just heard them talking about it. Okay. I never even knew anyone who tried not to. I mean, when it finally came, you're terrified. There was a whole bunch of other guys who were just as terrified. And,
right.
You know, you don't, you know, they didn't lie well.
What year did you graduate, Donna?
1968.
At what point in the year? Was it in the spring?
Yeah, in May. Okay. And then I started tech in June.
Okay. that 1968, as you've already said,
yeah.
was a very important year with regard to the war and apparently with
yeah.
regard to your thinking about it.
Absolutely.
When you heard about the shootings at Kent State, where were you? Do you remember?
I don't remember where I was. I probably just heard it on the nightly news.
Okay.
The conversation I remember was sitting, again, at the table with my dad, because
mm-hmm.
it's also when I knew that he had totally changed his mind, and we were talking about, again, I mean, we often talk about Vietnam at the table. It's Saturday afternoon, having hamburgers. He would make hamburgers for all our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember looking across the table from him saying, Dad, that was just a girl walking to class. That could have been me walking across the class. She wasn't a protester. She was going to class. She was doing what she was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And she was killed. And Dad got it. He got it that things were out of hand when you have National Guard with live bullets on a campus.
Mm-hmm.
And well, from that moment on, he just didn't speak about Vietnam the same way.
How did it change?
He would just say, it's not a good war. It's not right. What they're doing is not right. He wouldn't really get in big debates about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the most he could say was, it's not right.
But he didn't want to hold forth.
No.
In detail. In front of you, or do you think in general?
I think in general. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what he did at work and all. He was working for Tech then. But
now, how did he get that job at Tech? Do you remember?
He came back to Lubbock because one, my mother's parents were here, and he just knew that wherever we ended up, we were going to end up taking care of my grandparents.
Yes.
So we might as well come here.
Okay.
He thought he had some connections here. My dad hadn't really been one of those. Most people, when they know they're going to retire, they start lining up a job.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad just never really knew how to do that. I mean, he just wasn't that type of person.
Uh-huh.
So we came back here, and at first he just interviewed for a lot of jobs, and I never knew how hard that must have been.
Yes, and when you say it must have been hard, what do you mean?
He didn't have a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
He was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, 28 years. Are you going to want to hire someone who's been through two wars and is a commander?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be terrified of that man.
Right, the assumption is he's not going to be able to take direction.
The assumption is he's going to run rings around you.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And you're going to look like an idiot. So at first he thought he was going to work for Preston Smith and doing his campaign.
Now, Preston Smith was?
Running for governor
okay.
of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But then he, I think, very honestly analyzed my mom's condition. And so there was a job as assistant director, just one of the people, a counselor at Tech for financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually went to work. He worked the first month without pay, or the first 2 weeks without pay, because he said, give me the chance and I'll show you how good I am. And the guy did, and he ended up being great. And when that man, I think his name was Tom Stover, when he retired, he recommended my dad get it, even though Dad didn't have a degree or anything. And Dad went on to be director of financial aid. He worked for Tech for 10 years.
For 10 years from 1960, would you say 8?
Probably 68, yeah, okay. to 78.
Now, Tom Stowe, for the one who gave him the opportunity,
mm-hmm.
sounds like he might have been a little bit reluctant as well.
I think so. Mm-hmm. But Dad also, I mean, he knew some of the old-timers at Tech. He knew, former president of the university, Grover Murray. There were some people that had played on the football empathy with that. And they and the thing was about Tech, they remembered him from the Cotton Bowl.
Right, right. And he had been the only one to score that
yeah,
year.
I mean, it's a really big deal. Yeah. And everybody knows that when they went to the second Cotton Bowl, it was bullshit.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, it was the last year for the Southwest Conference.
Okay.
And Tech had never gone to the Cotton Bowl, and they really had a pathetic record, but because they'd never been, they kind of, like, let them go.
Okay, so it was sort of a mercy thing?
Yeah, it was a mercy thing. In fact, Dad got up and walked out of a conference about it.
Really?
Yeah, because it was after a stroke. But we went to this meeting at the Southwest Collection about, we're going to honor the players from 38-39, and here are the contemporary players. And the people they had talking was Dub Rushing, who was nothing more than a fan.
Uh-huh.
My dad was like, why the hell is he talking? But he was being polite. And then they went on to talk about how the current team was just like the old team and, you know, as gallant and all that. And Dad just stood up and said, bullshit, we're out of here. And we got up and walked out.
He was offended?
Yeah, absolutely.
And he was offended because
had been undefeated and untied. And no one else has ever done that.
He didn't like the kind of what he maybe saw as a false analogy.
Yeah, yeah, he thought it was bullshit. Mm-hmm. He had no tolerance for lies and bullshit. Yeah.
And he made that known.
He made that known. You know, he was like, we're out of here. I said, yes, sir.
Now, you started as a student at Tech in the fall of 1968.
Summer. Yeah, I was out of high school about 3 days.
And
Started Tech
in the summer.
Yeah.
Why was that, instead of taking the summer off?
I was bored. Why? School was too... I mean, I breezed my grades. Well, I just found my report card actually from that last year. Outside of French, which I just didn't pay attention to, I took art courses in government. I mean, I was so bored with high school, I couldn't wait to start college.
Okay. Uh-huh. And so you started right away.
Started right away.
And what was it like having your dad be a Tech employee as you were a student, or did that not affect you?
Oh, it was great.
It
meant I had a ride to school. It meant that when things got jammed up in registration, he walked two doors down, knocked on the door of Pete Peterson, who was the director of registration at the time, registrar, and I got it taken care of. Got me summer jobs or jobs every registration from then on, working registration. You didn't do it online, obviously.
Right.
And if you were a worker, you got to register first, so you got your classes.
So you actually worked registration?
Yeah, it used to be in the Coliseum, and all the departments would have their cards lined up, and you'd stand in line and ask for a card. When the cards ran out, kids would have to get out of line, figure out a new schedule, and, you know.
And the cards were what? How you got into a class?
Yeah, you would bring your card with you and show it to the teacher.
Oh, and you had to have that card in order to be enrolled in the class.
Yeah, it was a real hands-on. Okay. In some ways, it was better.
Now, why do you say that? Then you mean better than registering online?
Yeah, well, because things get jammed now. And I just had a friend who, at her school, the entire computer system went down during registration.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun. I mean, it was kind of an ordeal, but it was fun. And so it was great having Dad work there because he knew the system. And when things got jammed, I had help.
And he was on your side.
Absolutely on my side.
Yeah, and what about your sister?
Oh, she partied.
Now, was she still going to, she going to Coronado?
Yeah, she went to Coronado. She gave the graduation speech. She was in drama and oral and terp.
Uh-huh.
She started Tech and majored in theater and parties. And she'll tell you that. She had a 1.0 or 1.4 her first 2.5 years of college.
And what happened after 2.5 years?
Or 3 years. Well, she got married. I got married right after college, after I graduated.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I like 3 hours. Got married, came back, got the 3 hours. And she got married right after I did to a man who had not been in Vietnam but had been in Thailand as a demolitions expert.
Uh-huh.
And then when did she get serious? And then after I was widowed, which was just less than 2 years later, she got a divorce and came back to Lubbock. They had already moved back to Lubbock, and she started school, and she got serious about getting a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up with a 4.
And what did she end up studying?
Human development, early childhood development, and specialty in female sexual dysfunction.
And she lives where?
She lives in Austin.
Okay.
She's a benefits analysis officer.
Okay. And did you stay with art as an undergrad?
It was sort of this general art degree with a specialty in art history, but they didn't have a degree in art history, and my dad wasn't quite liberal enough or supportive enough to let me get a degree in art. I had to have something that looked like I could fall back on or something.
And that was supposed to be art history?
Oh, I don't know what it was supposed to be, but it wasn't supposed to be studio art. But he did keep, he asked me to buy all my supplies, or as many as I could, at a bookstore on campus so that he could keep, well, he kept tabs of what I spent on art supplies. I lived at home all through college.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because he could then change the amount of money given to art students when they got loans.
Based on his information as to how much it cost to actually
be an
art student?
Yeah, that it costs much more to be an art student, architect, and music student than their formulas had allocated.
So you were kind of providing a source of kind of secret information about how much it actually cost.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he utilized that in
and
developing
financial. And he changed the rules.
Did
he changed two rules. Yeah, he changed that rule because he found out that architects spend a lot of money on art supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Artists do. Music students have to buy all their own music and stuff, and that cost. I mean, he just didn't know that. And he said,
right.
Well, we're not allocating that. I mean, we allocate books. We know what books cost and lab fees and all this in our financial aid packet, but we're not really allowing for supplies that are necessary.
Uh-huh.
The other thing he did is he started formulating. He figured out that kids borrow a lot of money, and they didn't know what trouble they're getting into.
Okay.
And so he said, okay, there's a point where if you've borrowed, let's say, $10,000, we will let every student who's borrowed that much money know that the month after they graduate, they will have to start paying back X amount of dollars.
And tell them how much that's going to be.
And tell them how much that's going to be. Then he would suggest if you know you're going to get a job and that's okay, you got it covered, it's fine. But what you may want to do is take off a semester, start paying back some of this loan now, so that it'll be lower later.
And did students kind of take that up on?
Yeah. That happened to. He actually did that, I think, statewide. And then maybe nationally it was done.
Uh-huh.
Because kids were getting in serious debt problems.
Right, borrowing for their tuition and fees.
Yeah.
And you lived at home this whole time?
Yeah, I lived at home.
How were things going at home?
Horrid.
Okay.
Well, Mom was a raging alcoholic by then, but, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing how you cannot notice that. I would grab a ride with Dad in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I would spend most of my time in the library just reading, and then I'd come home with him at night, and then I had a boyfriend. I mean, two things. I don't think I ever appreciated how good it was to be able to live at home because it was just safe. And in those days, the dorms had rules about when girls had to be in and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a lot more freedom, plus I just had safety. I had food cooked for me and my laundry done.
Now, was your mom doing that kind of stuff at home?
Oh, yeah, when she was sober, sure.
Okay. And during those years at Tech, when did you stay there the whole time?
Yeah, I got my first degree from there in 72.
Okay, in 72.
Got my master's in 77.
During those years as an undergraduate at Tech, do you remember much about the political climate on campus?
It was not as intense as elsewhere, but one of the neat things was they were building onto, I think, what's now the Science Quadrangle. They were doing some construction in there around the chemistry building. And they had a big fence up, a construction fence, and people would do political slogans on that fence.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was a great fence. It was a wonderful fence. I can remember one in particular that a guy from down the street wrote, Richard Holton wrote this one. And he had painted it black, and this was during Biafra, too, and he painted a little starving black kid, and he just, what he wrote on it was, "But give a damn, please give a damn." But there'd be anti-war, and then there'd be, you know, pro-war things. And they had an anti-war demonstration on campus, and the police came. And Tech students were really polite. They lined it up in a line and turned in their IDs.
They turned in their IDs?
So that they could be identified.
To whom did they give their IDs?
The university police. So they could be identified as, you know.
As having done at this demonstration?
Yeah. So there weren't any great, there would always be someone around the student union, and, you know, John Denver went to school here, and there'd be musicians who would come through, and we had a peace concert out in a big cotton field on the edge of town, somewhere out by the strip, on a spring day that turned bitterly cold, blowing gusts, at some of the local churches, Episcopalian and Methodist Presbyterian churches, took everybody in, because it was after Woodstock, and it was supposed to be like a, supposed to be a peace festival, but it ended up being a horrible fan-blowing, terrible mess.
And so when you say they took you in, what happened?
Well, they took, I lived at home, they took the people who were going to camp out in, because it got down to freezing. They just let them sleep in the sanctuary and gave them a meal.
So were there a lot of people who attended that who were not from Lubbock?
Oh, yeah, probably about 300 or 400, but that
really?
Was a lot for Lubbock. They were, you know,
right.
They were freaking out over that.
Right.
And so I think that, I don't think anybody by that time was for the war, except for the ROTC guys.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that nobody, they were all in college. It was an abstract thing. And they weren't going to speak out against America. Although, there were big, I mean, this is the interesting part. As an undergraduate, because I had two different boyfriends, when I was with one of them, I was a Democrat. When I was with the other one, I was a Republican. I mean, I was not political. I probably joined Young Republicans because my boyfriend was president.
Okay.
And because Texas had always been such a Democratic party.
Yes.
That I thought you should have a choice. I mean, to me, it was about that. I didn't know enough to know the difference between the two parties.
Were there particular feelings about Richard Nixon that you remember?
Yeah, they were all pro-Nixon.
Pro-Nixon?
I mean, yeah, we were Young Republicans. They thought he was great. You know, we were idiots.
And you were not one of the participants in the anti-war demonstration
that you talked
about. Who? What kind of kids were? Do you remember?
Philosophy and art majors.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice kids. I mean, nothing, you know, we had one guy on campus, I can't remember his name, who was trying to start an SDS chapter here, and it didn't work.
That didn't work.
That didn't work.
It died for lack of interest?
Yeah.
Was he ever targeted in any way?
Oh, yeah. He was photographed a lot, and, you know.
By whom?
I would assume city police.
Okay. Oh, do you remember his name?
I'll try to think of it for a long time.
Oh, sure, I know.
I mean, a long, long time. He was real good-looking, real charismatic. But it was also when Transcendental Meditation was brought to campus and taught free.
Mm-hmm.
What else happened? The women's movement, you know, by my senior year, I'd stopped wearing bras.
Okay. Pretty radical?
It was pretty radical. It was pretty radical at Texas Tech.
Uh-huh.
Birth control became available. There was one doctor in town. Where you can get, you know, he would probably fill you up. I mean, literally, you know, he accosted me when I got my pills.
Really?
Oh yeah, it was sleazy. But there was a lawyer in town that if you got busted for marijuana and you were a good looking girl, you could trade.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was, the things came, but they came in what I always just call the Lubbock Shuffle way. You know?
What do you mean by that Lubbock Shuffle?
This is defined, actually I'm stealing the words from Deborah Molasses, that's an artist in town.
Uh-huh.
You want to do a piece of art and you want neon, but it's Lubbock, so you have to use Christmas lights.
And that's because why?
We just don't have the resources of a big town. We don't have the money. We don't have the support system, so we make do.
How does that fit with this idea of there was corruption around getting, you know,
if there had been enough. If there had been enough doctors here that just cared about patients, there would be more than one doctor that you could get a pill from.
You wouldn't have to put up with.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You wouldn't. If there had been more than one lawyer even willing to take on cases about marijuana, you wouldn't have to put out.
Did either of these, I assume they're men.
Yeah, of course.
Ever get reported to the police?
No.
And would anything have been done if they had been?
No.
In
fact, one went on to be very famous.
Really?
Yeah, but I'm not going to mention his name.
Okay.
I'm not going to be these.
I'm with you. That's fine. That's totally fine.
Yeah.
But you're talking about a particular time of extreme change, really.
Well, Lubbock, this is, you know, when the rest of the country, like I was out in San Francisco in the summer of 69
mm-hmm.
with a boyfriend who went to San Francisco State.
Wow.
Who was a football player he was a football player at San Francisco Tech.
Okay.
So he was part of the group that retook back the buildings after the sit-in.
Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
He lived in a fraternity. He wasn't a member of the fraternity, but he lived in a fraternity right off of the tip of Golden Gate Park, which means he was off of Haight and Ashbury.
Right, yes.
So it's like, and he was a military brat, so it was like everybody, I mean, I was more than aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Did I understand it? I didn't do drugs.
Mm-hmm.
There were drugs in Lubbock. There were people doing drugs in Lubbock. But Lubbock wasn't as political. I mean, it sort of came down to, I'm going to school. Is it going to help me get an A in algebra, you know?
Right, okay. Uh-huh.
And I think that that's Lubbock is just, I mean, I think Lubbock, I like how my Ivins talks about Lubbock. You know, it's one of her favorite places because you know where you stand with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was never a hotbed. There were so many great universities doing wonderful work. We didn't have professors. I mean, my Latin teacher on the moratorium day,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Moratorium day meaning?
It would be a day, usually the beginning in the fall semester, they called for a national moratorium where you didn't have to honor all that had died in Vietnam. You didn't have, everybody was supposed to boycott class.
Okay.
He had been taken prisoner in Lithuania.
And he being the professor?
Yeah, the professor.
Uh-huh.
And he said, Dr. Jurgen, no, what is it? I can't remember. He's dead now. Anyway, he said, I can't tell you what to do, but I'm not taking roll that day.
Mm-hmm.
And he wore a black armband all day.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of only a handful that would have ever, I mean, people just wouldn't speak out about it.
They even that was a fairly radical gesture.
It was a pretty radical thing.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the fence around the construction site was the most radical thing that happened.
Did you ever take pictures or see that as an inspiration to art?
It's an exploration of art. I've never forgotten.
Uh-huh.
I think it's what helped. I mean, I do work that always has words in it, and I became a feminist. I mean, I became a feminist my senior year. I read Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
And
so
that was hugely influential.
Absolutely. It changed my mind. I mean, it was the straw that changed my mind. I had other readings. My Aunt Future talked to me about, you know, being independent and
mm-hmm.
stuff. I was married at the time. Actually, it was after I graduated, so it was that summer. Hank was an economics major. And when I said, look at what I read. He said, well, how silly is that? We can't underemploy 51% of the population. That makes no economic sense.
Now, Hank was your husband.
Yeah, my first husband.
Uh-huh. And he had attended Tech as well?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, he graduated from Tech, business,
okay.
Economics major, international trade. He was getting ready to go to law school when he was killed.
Okay, was that an accidental death?
Yeah, he was killed by a drunk driver.
Oh, okay.
On his motorcycle.
And that was in December of 73?
Correct.
I think you had told me?
Yes.
Okay. Your sort of personal evolution, did it in any way, do you think, sort of parallel what was happening in the rest of the country, or did you kind of think you were on your own sort of path and Lubbock was a special?
I just thought I was behind
place.
The curve. I mean, I think that when other people were going to SDS meetings or going to sit-ins or dropping acid, I mean, I never dropped it. All of that, I just think that I missed it. I mean, I think I got involved in art, and I just missed it. And it took me a long time to catch up in terms of what were the real issues, not what were the emotional knee-jerk issues. I can remember the summer of 72, after graduating, Hank and I went to New Jersey to sell advertising
mm-hmm.
in college telephone directories. His stepfather owned the company that printed them. And we were in Trenton, New Jersey, and in Newark. I mean, holy shit, they were the hotbeds.
Yes, it was a completely different environment.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I'm a little white girl with a Texas accent and not even smart enough to read the name. I can remember going into a Black Panther gift shop type place, you know?
Okay.
And knowing instantly that my life was in danger. And the only thing that got me out was that obviously everybody knew I was stupid.
That you were naive?
Beyond naive.
Okay.
I was stupid.
Okay.
I mean, you know, here is a Black Panther head shop.
Uh-huh.
And I'm asking if they want to buy advertising in an all-white school telephone directory.
And how did you actually wander into that place?
We were told to do it. We were given a list of places to go.
Was this in Newark?
Yeah, or Trenton, one of the towns.
Okay.
Remember. And so you're given a list of cards. It's a way to make. In the Deep South, you make great money doing because everybody wants to be in the college phone
sure.
book.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in Texas, you can make a year's wage in a month, literally. You know, all you have to do is like go to people and go, "Hey, it's for the tech phone book." Oh yeah, here I am. Give me a full page. Well, up there, there's a million little colleges. You know, every block, and. We were foreigners. I mean, it was really scary. We drove into either Trenton or Newark, one of them. I can't remember now. Probably Trenton. 1 o'clock in the morning, pulling a motorcycle, and ended up on the black side of town.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we didn't get shot or killed.
When you said it was this place that you walked into was a head shop, can you say what that is?
Yeah, there were you could buy papers, there were bongs everywhere.
By papers you mean?
Papers for marijuana, there were marijuana posters on the wall, and there were Black Panther posters on the wall. It was all black people in there with afros, and, you know, most of the slogans and stuff on the wall were about the Black Panthers and Black Power. Hello!
Right. And you knew when you walked in that you were somewhere you weren't supposed to be in some way?
Yeah,
And what happened when you walked out of there? Did you talk to where you were with Hank?
No, I was alone.
Oh, you were alone.
He'd go do his set of cards and I'd go do mine.
Oh, okay.
We'd meet up at night. I'd have the car and he'd have the motorcycle.
And you walked out of there thinking what? Do you remember?
This was stupid. I was angry at my father-in-law because he had set us up. He knew damn good and well that this was a hell hole. They had screwed up the telephone directories the last 2 years. He was sending us to the worst place on his list. Always the summers before, Hank had worked in the Deep South and made good money, really good money.
Mm-hmm.
And he had said, "Well, it's my wedding gift to you. I'm going to give you this job. I'm going to give you a job." Well, he sent us to the worst screwed up mess, and he knew he was sending us to places where we couldn't make money.
Why did you think he did that?
Because I think he's a jerk. I mean, he was an alcoholic jerk, and he was always jealous because Hank was a child by the first marriage that had died when Hank's father had been a Navy pilot and died when Hank was 2 months old of brain cancer. And he had always been envious of that relationship that his wife had with her first Navy pilot husband.
I see. What year was Hank born, do you remember?
He was born in 51.
Okay. And the Navy pilot who was his father, do you remember his name?
Mm-hmm. His name was Henry Grady Brewer II.
How do you spell his last name?
B-R-E-W-E-R.
And the first name was?
Henry.
Henry, okay. And he had served in the Pacific Theater?
I guess so. I don't really know.
Okay.
I mean,
Did Hank know much about him?
Just that he had been a Navy pilot, and he was from Clarksdale, Mississippi. His grandmother still lives in Clarksdale.
And did Hank have any feelings about the Vietnam War particularly that you remember?
At once he was going to join ROTC, and then he decided not to.
Okay.
He went on to just not believe in it. He was getting ready to go to law school. He just didn't believe
law school. In it. Let's talk about your dad again for a little while. The end of his career at Texas Tech.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, did he join any veterans organizations, or did he have any affiliations around town that were connected to his having had this amazing career?
The only thing he joined was the Letterman's Association.
What was that?
It's for men who've lettered in sports at Tech.
Okay. And that was kind of his social group?
Yeah, they met on the morning sometimes for breakfast before homecoming day. They would have a big breakfast for all returning football players on homecoming day.
Like kind of once a year?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was it.
But he didn't sort of have friends in town that he hung around with?
No.
Because he was very busy at home, trying to handle things at home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He told me when he retired from Tech, he could have stayed on. I mean, it wasn't a forced retirement. It was just by then he was vested in it and he could do it. That he knew he could either do his job or he could do mom, but he couldn't do both.
And your mother was becoming less and less well over time, would
yeah.
you say? Uh-huh. And her health generally was deteriorating, or?
Well, how can you tell? She was a binge drinker. She would start drinking and be drunk for a month, and she would be passed out on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, passed out, throwing up, going to the bathroom on herself, not combing her hair and just drinking out of a bottle for two weeks at a time. And then she'd, it'd take her about a week to get to that condition, and then it'd take her a week to get sober, and she'd go through massive DTs. When, 79, I had a blood clot. I was in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and my dad came to see me, and then he didn't come the next day, but he called because he had left Mom alone just, 45 minutes to come and see me.
Yes.
And she had set her mom up. She had fallen going to get a bottle and cracked her head open, Another time she set her hair on fire, her face on fire. And so, he just couldn't leave her alone. And even if his oldest daughter is in the hospital with a blood clot, he couldn't come and see me because my mom was too bad off.
And did she go into the hospital again any time in this
Yeah,
period?
We committed her again.
Uh-huh.
We committed her again.
When did your dad actually retire from tech? Do you remember?
I'm going to have to think that. I graduated, I think he did in 78.
Okay. How did he feel about retiring?
He really didn't want to.
He had
already developed diabetes.
Okay.
And he just thought that the pressure was getting to him. Between mom and the job and then, taking care of diabetes.
Because at that time he had become director.
Director
of financial
aid. Yeah.
So he was reluctant.
Yeah, because he couldn't go to meetings. He just couldn't do what he needed. He knew how the job needed to be done, and
He didn't feel well enough to do it?
He felt well enough. He just didn't feel like he could concentrate enough because of mom.
I see.
Because by then, he and I were both moved out of the house. And he,
right. And so he was alone with it.
Yeah, he was alone with it.
Mm-hmm. Your dad had a stroke at some stage.
Yeah, he had a stroke in probably 12 years later.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. I have to think back for about 12 years later.
And did you move back to Lubbock around that time?
Yeah, I had been living in Dallas doing my art and working for the natural science, the science place in Dallas in Fair Park. And Dad had a stroke. Mama called and told me Dad had had a stroke and not to come home for a while. And I was scheduled to come home in 3 weeks anyway, so I came home in 3 weeks and realized it was much worse than I had thought. Dad was already home, but it was really very bizarre. And then that summer, it was like in winter, probably around March or April.
Mm-hmm.
But in June, I was scheduled to come here and do a workshop for Shake Hands with Your Future, do an art workshop.
Okay.
And I went the first day, and then the next morning, Dad woke me up. He could kind of talk and walk.
Uh-huh.
And said that Mom had fallen, and could I help him get her up? And she was dead. She had a massive coronary. And so I stayed here 3 weeks, hired someone to take care of Dad for 2 weeks, went back to Dallas, packed up, settled up affairs in Dallas, and moved back here.
Was that... Was there ever any question in your mind about what it was you were going to do once your mother had died? And your father
I had to first get through the funeral. Once we got through the funeral, my sister was in Canada and her son was here with us. And once we sort of overcame that, I knew that I was going to stay here 3 weeks, to just see and then hire someone. I think what I didn't know, I thought that it would only take a year to get my dad well,
mm-hmm.
and then I'd be back in Dallas. It was after the first year and a half, 2 years, and I realized he wasn't going to get any better. He did great as a stroke survivor. He still was able to give himself injections and do his pills. He was great.
Mm-hmm.
But someone was going to live with him. So at the end of a year, we had made a deal, sort of a verbal deal. I just said, Dad, I'd really like to stay on if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed to stay on when I was here until he died.
Which was when?
Okay, it was the 28th of February, 9 years ago.
And?
I guess it'll be 10 years this February.
This February. Did your dad express any particular wishes about whether he wanted to be buried here in Lubbock or somewhere else?
Oh, yeah. He had open heart surgery before his stroke,
uh-huh.
a number of years before. And he brought me into the hospital room when nobody else was there, and he told me exactly what he wanted. He mainly said, call the base. They'll handle everything. It's paid for. I want to be buried here in Lubbock next to where my grandparents are, because he knew that's where my mom wanted to be buried. We didn't know that my mom would die first, but, you know, they were going to have her joint headstone.
Uh-huh.
I said, well, Dad, you can be buried in Arlington. I mean, you got the medals, and, you know.
Sure.
He said, I want to be buried there. I want to be buried here. And I said, what do you want? He said, I don't want a service. Just tell him to play taps. That's it.
And is that what happened?
Oh, yeah.
And so he is lying here in Lubbock.
He's out at the, I don't know what it's called now, it's the old city of Lubbock.
The city of Lubbock.
That one.
The big one.
The big one. He's out there next to my grandparents and my mom.
Okay.
And we played taps. And we had a 21-gun salute.
Did you have Air Force representation there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. My sister has a flag. We wanted, I wanted a flyby, but they told us you had to be on active duty to get a flyby.
So you compromised and said, oh, okay.
Well, it's either that or it's like cost, like, you know, $500,000 or something.
Sure, I'm sure.
I was like, oh, yeah, right, we're going to do that.
And so you still live in the house?
Yeah, I still live in the house.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, actually both my parents died in this house.
Okay. And what street is that on?
27th Street.
Okay. Future, earlier you had told me that there was an additional story that you had recalled about the filming by your father during World War II of the concentration camp.
Yeah, the story comes to me from my sister.
Okay.
So, that he was, it was, you know, after the concentration camps were liberated, he was doing regular reconnaissance flying, and saw some walking skeletons. He said that's what it looked like, and
mm-hmm.
he just sat down, and went in, and there was this concentration camp. And what I know is that I have a whole series of photographs of a concentration camp. Now, whether the story was that someone else did this or that he shot them, all I know is I have the original photos.
Okay.
And they're horrible. They're horrible, horrible, horrible. If anyone ever doubted evil, you know, that evil exists, these photos prove that men can commit evil. I mean, just whole bodies in ovens.
Why do you think your father kept those photographs?
To remind him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he knew that they were important documents, and
mm-hmm.
that's what it was about.
And he spoke to you about them on one occasion?
Yeah, we got in a typical, I mean, for my mom being an alcoholic, when she was sober, things were so cool. I mean, she was like a great mom.
Wow.
Saturday, and that's why I made it so hard.
Cause yes.
You know, it was just like Jekyll
yeah.
and Hyde. On Saturdays, the tradition was we would either go eat pizza, some pizza place, or my dad would make these incredible hamburgers. I mean, he'd put all these spices, really bad spices in it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they made them great, and really big, and melted cheese, and oh, God, it was just too much fun. And any little boyfriend we had or girlfriends would come over, because
sure.
everybody knew my dad, and my dad loved doing it. I mean, you know, our little boyfriends or even male friends could eat two or three hamburgers, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They loved it. It was just too cool. And part of the deal was we had, it is very typical that for my age group and our military families, you ate dinner together,
yeah.
period.
Mm-hmm.
No question. Breakfast might be a little bit chaotic. Lunch you did at school. Dinner, everybody was at home. Husbands were there. Kids were there. One table eating dinner.
Right.
Okay. We never stopped that. We always did that, even when Mom was drunk. I mean, she might be drunk in the living room, but we would eat dinner together.
Okay.
Well, on Saturday, dinner ended up meaning lunch, and we would sit around the table and talk about
uh-huh.
things going on, and it was not unusual to argue about Vietnam, and this was pre-Kent State.
Okay.
And so I'm arguing about Vietnam,
And Dad's just had enough of it, you know, because obviously I didn't know what the shit I was talking about. I mean, you could just see his, you know, he was just like tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he got up and went into the garage and got and rumbled around for a while and came back and just handed me this stack of photos. Because
mm-hmm.
my smart aleck comment had been, I don't know why anybody ever fought in any war. You know, I just being a smart aleck.
Right.
You know, you got to be.
Sure.
You're new in college. You got to
sure.
be a smart aleck.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and he just looked at me and he said, this is the reason. And that's it. That's all he had to ever say about it. He never told me another thing about it. Just showed him.
And you sat there with the photos that day?
Yeah. At the dinner table.
And what effect did that have on you, teacher?
I wanted to throw up.
Mm-hmm.
It just totally silenced me. I was shocked. You know, so I still keep hiding them for myself.
Right.
They're just, I got it. I mean, I was like, oh, my God, this is what people can do to each other. So, you know, and I suddenly realized my dad was one of, you know, thousands of heroes who said, we're not going to let that happen. We're not going to let that happen. And that they would risk their lives to stop something that was more evil than I could ever comprehend. And that all my fantasies about, oh, you could have tried, you could have negotiated something, you know, that the Nazi regime was killing people for no other reason than they were Jewish, gypsy, homosexual, whatever. Whatever
right.
they wanted to make up.
Right.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm. Whatever group.
Whatever group.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and from that moment on, I my theory was, if they're coming for me, you better believe they're coming for you tomorrow. You know, and it just changed my life.
Teacher, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your dad that we haven't covered yet? Or
well, one, I think probably for me, this is when he died, the biggest honor, it was an amazing, it wasn't a large funeral. I mean, I've been to funerals where there's a million dignitaries and lots of people standing remotely, you know, whatever that's about. What amazed me is that people came who had been in the service with my dad.
Okay.
Well, actually, I'll tell you this whole story because I'll cry. After he had a stroke, I got a call from one of the men who had been his sergeant in Arkansas, Sergeant
mm-hmm.
Bertram. And he said, we're coming through and just want to say hi to the colonel. I said, well, you can come on by, but, you know, Dad's had a stroke. I'll try to get his memory up, but and he said, no problem. We only got 30 minutes. And so, and I knew that meant 30 minutes. Well, I had coffee ready. I also knew that, you know.
mm-hmm.
Been training in the military. Have coffee. Had a little cake ready. Got to do that. And they talked. And my dad remembered. And they remembered a few things. And they wouldn't stay for dinner. It truly was only 30 minutes. And then Sergeant Bertram, whose daughter had been one of my best friends that I still talk to, actually, said, well, sir, I stopped by because they just moved to Florida. He said, when I first moved to Florida, he said, I've only had two good commanders in 30 years of service. You and this other colonel. And we moved to the same town with this colonel, and I kept telling the wife that I was going to go by and say hi. Never did, and then he died. And I just swore I was going to come and see you. And he said, because I get to.
It's okay. You can take your time.
I just have to salute you one more time. Because of the type of commander you were and the type of man you are. And he stood up. My dad stood up. And he saluted my daddy.
Mm-hmm.
My dad saluted him back. And I was just bawling. I was still bawling.
What a wonderful thing that he made the effort to do that.
I drove cross country to do it.
What an incredible thing. That's
yeah.
Quite a statement about your dad.
Yeah, and I walked him out, you know, to the car, and I said, just bawling. I mean, I'm just bawling then, I'm bawling now. Bawling every time I tell the damn story. I said, and everyone called him Birch. I said, Sergeant Birch, thank you. That was so much. He said, no. He said, you have no idea what type of commander your father was. He said, you just don't. And I just, you know, like, I got it. I just got it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of his other sergeant's sons came to Dad's funeral. My nephew came with his Navy Medal Cross, whatever is right under the Medal of Honor he got. So he got the next one down.
Okay. Your nephew?
Yeah, my nephew, oh God, his first name's Akins. It's not, that's not Tito, it's Brett.
Okay.
Brett Akins.
And he came to the funeral.
Came to the funeral, and then, who came? The secretaries he had had when he was director of financial aid, they came.
Yes.
And this was long after he'd retired.
Yes.
Some of the students he had given loans to came. Mm-hmm. And one of them wrote a 10-page letter to me, I don't still have it, just telling me how he had given her back her dignity and didn't make her feel like she was nothing for asking for money. Then some of the men he had and women he had been in rehab with at the Y and the pool.
After his stroke.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, oh, and then somebody he played football with. So it was like
wow.
This whole career. And I thought, that's the true value of a man, is that it wasn't just that he played football. It was that he went on to be a fighter pilot. Then he went on to be a base commander. I mean, for some people, after the war was over with, they didn't know what to do. They dissolved.
That's true.
You know, it was horrible for them. Dad went on to be a better base commander, you know. Then he's a financial aid director, and he helps people, helps kids.
He touched a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm. Not in a glorious showboat way, but just in a real way. And then...
Yes, in a real way.
In a real way. And then, for me, the most courage he ever showed... It's when he had to learn how to talk and walk again. That's what took courage.
Yes.
And that's what, you know, when the people from rehab came, I just lost it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was like all the other is, you know, you can know about it, it's that. And that was what, and that, seven and a half, 8 years I took care of him, he never failed to thank me every day.
To thank you.
Yes. For taking care of him, for giving him his meals, for being there.
Well, I think he had, it seems, developed this very special relationship with you all the way back at some of his earliest...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
...postings.
Oh, yeah, we were, I was always his daughter. I mean, it was never, that was always really obvious. But it was also because he was truly an officer and a gentleman. I mean, he opened doors for people. I mean, he really... was a gentleman. And he was a man's man. I mean, that was, you know, and those are old-fashioned terms and can be interpreted sexist, but, you know, he probably was a little bit of a sexist, but with the best of intentions. You know, his mother died in his arms. His mother-in-law had died in his arms. He really had an incredibly gentle side.
And a certain kind of quiet nobility at times. Like.
Yeah, and then just a year ago, I went on militarybrats.com and found someone who had been in our Sunday school class. He taught Sunday school up at Kinchland and contacted him and said, you know, you're the one student my dad always asked about. And this man, who's now my age,
mm-hmm.
you know, wrote back immediately and said, oh, my God, I can't believe, you know, your father was... you know, the one who changed, you know, helped change my life and set me on this path. And, you know, we've kept up a friendship now because based on that.
It's wonderful that you can find out some of those sort of changed trajectories that your dad was responsible for. And those are just the ones that you've kind of been able to find out about.
Well, and then at the same time, you know, I found a stash of girly magazines. You know, my sister got kind of freaked out when I did that, but I said, you know, I love the fact that he was a human being.
Okay, right.
I mean, and I think that's real important for people to know is that you don't, I think that it made him even more. Yeah. And so that's what I remember is all that. Oh, and the cat walked with him every day. We had a cat that would go for walks with him. I didn't know cats, you know.
This was during his rehab?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cat would slink along in the shadows.
Yeah, I never asked you about pets or anything.
Well, Dad wasn't raised with pets because they were too poor, but Mom, when they were first married, they had a little terrier named Flick Flick for the camera.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And then when we went to Thailand, we had to give her to my Aunt Helen. And we came back, and Mom always had French poodles. Our first one was named Mr. Nuot.
Uh-huh. Mr. Nuot.
Yeah, for Mustache. because it's Thai for mustache.
Yeah.
And then we'd have canaries, and we'd have Siamese cats. Then eventually, we always had poodles, but we eventually ended up with stray cats and no birds, got tired of birds.
Uh-huh.
And then when my dad died, they had a little Shih Tzu, Lhasa Apso mix,
uh-huh.
and this cat that would follow him.
Do you think the cat was or the dog were a source of comfort to him?
Oh, yeah.
During his rehab, do you remember
Oh,
that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. They just adored him, and they would sit on his lap, you know, and let him pet him and just be a comfort. They were just there.
And that was good for him, do you think?
I think so.
Uh-huh.
I think that the hardest thing for him was having mom die. I mean, that was the love of his life, and I knew that once he lived the first year, we were okay. Because I thought he was going to die of a broken heart. But, you know, it also got pretty bad with mom, so.
Well, I remember the story that you told yesterday about him walking into the soda shop.
And Singer,
uh-huh.
That's true, Broadway drug.
And he made up his mind right then, sounds
yep.
like.
he did, and I mean, I have no reason to doubt that story. I heard it my whole life.
Yes, it sounds true.
Yeah, it does. And my mom's theory was, yeah, it took him 10 years to do it. And he was like, yeah, and you got me, you know, I mean, it banner back and
forth. Of course, sure.
But it really was. It was, he just, you know, it did, you know. And it makes it kind of tough. Growing up under that those archetype stories, you know.
Yeah, because that didn't really happen
for
in
me?
The 70s. I mean,
well,
not
and
that
they're
I remember.
Not happening in the 2004s either.
Right, right. I'm with you.
And so, I think one of the interesting things about just this life, you know, this lifetime, is that at his funeral, I found out he had these medals that were kind of important. I mean, I still don't know what they are. We have a list somewhere. My sister has them all in the flag, you know, but I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I should know, but none of that ever mattered to me because it never really mattered to him. I just
mm-hmm.
didn't. But I found out he was like a hero, you know, a
yes.
real life, got medals for it, been there,
yes.
you know, hero. And had been an influence on all these people. I'm like, well, that's a pretty high standard that when I require of my friends and of myself,
mm-hmm.
my friends and my lovers, the standard I'm requiring is not make-believe. It's one I've lived with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard part for people to get because they, one, don't believe in it, and they can't understand my commitment to it because they've never seen it.
Right. People with completely different backgrounds.
Can't see it.
Right.
You know, they can't. They don't understand what it's like to have a, you know, that's what it is.
And yet it's very essential to who you are.
Yeah. Well,
who he
yeah.
was is essential
well,
to who you
yeah,
are.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like his favorite expression was, you've got to be able to look yourself in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was it. It was like, whatever you do, can you look yourself in the mirror?
And what did he mean by that?
Can you look yourself in the eye? You can lie to everybody else, but can you lie to yourself? Like, you know, if you make a decision, it may not be popular, but can you live with it?
And that has to do with morality and ethics.
Absolutely. It had to do with decisions he made online. I can remember him telling stories of he'd have to make a decision online, and the sergeant would argue with him or something, and he'd say, "Sergeant, I'll put it in writing, but the buck stops here. I'll take it. It's mine."
Meaning the responsibility.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's what he would say. He would just say, "Walk your talk." Take, you know, I mean, it was very simple for him.
Yes. Uh-huh.
If you say it, do it. And if you do it, you don't have to say it. You know? And if you're in charge, in fact, I found a plaque he had that was like, said, "Turn right." And then it's just this little saying he had, which was, if I tell you to turn right, turn right. Don't ask questions. I don't like giving these orders, but sometimes they're necessary because they might save your life.
Mm-hmm.
So when I tell you to turn right, by God, turn right. You know, don't argue with me.
Right.
And he just thought, you know, that you had a response. I mean, he was a very responsible person. So I never left my mom.
Right.
You know, and that, so when you take on a job, you do it to the best of your ability. If you fuck up, you take the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
if it goes well, you give the credit to everybody. He would tell, you know, the old military story, but especially in field maintenance, who's the most important? The pilot who flies the plane? The engineer who designed the plane? The maintenance guy who keeps it up? The cook who feeds the maintenance guy and the pilot?
Mm-hmm.
You know? A family that says, you know, who's the most important? You can't take any of them out.
Right.
Those are incredible lifetime lessons.
He sounds like a great guy.
He was. Still is. I mean, he's,
yeah.
You know, he still hangs around here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but those were, and that's, I think those are some of the lessons that when I talked to my other friends who were raised in the military, all those surveys that were done about how horrible it is for being raised in the military were done by people who weren't raised in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know what we got from it. You know,
the good stuff, the important things.
Yeah, we got some, yeah, well, you know, the hard thing about moving, I can make friends pretty damn quick.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know how to pack real well.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly, you know,
uh-huh.
and travel and sort of fly by my suits on my pants, you know.
Right, and adapt and trust yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, I've read a lot of books on military dependents that talk about how hard our life was. And I'm like, you weren't there. How do you know?
Right.
Yeah, but that's it. That's what I like. I mean, he really did pass on lessons that I think he always had in him, but that were reaffirmed by the time period he was in the military.
Well, thank you very much for participating.
Oh, thank you.